Hey everybody, this is Ted Moss from the Being Funny Podcast, and have I got good news for you. I know there's a lot of people who listen to this podcast that just might want to give stand-up comedy a try. So I was thinking back over my stand-up comedy journey, and I realized it's really difficult to get good information. I mean, I read books on it, or I looked for resources to help me, and there was not a lot of those things around. Also, I toured the country and did open mics and beginning level stand-up shows, showcases throughout the country, and I found out that that was universally true. Most places you go don't have a good educational system to help people who want to do stand-up comedy. So I've taken the last 4 months and built something called the Funny 15 Masterclass in Stand-Up Comedy. It's for all you people that want to get going in stand-up comedy or just begun. I actually was pretty fortunate because we've got probably 50 nationally touring comedians coming out of Detroit and probably at least another 50 really strong stand-up comedians that could do a hosting spot at most any club in the country. And so I had a peer group to come up with and learn from, but still it was difficult to figure out all the ins and outs of stand-up comedy. So what I have done is I've gone back over the last 4 years of podcasts and taken out some of the best advice from stand-up comedians that I had on my show, put it together with a battery of questions like what to do, what not to do, biggest mistakes, how to look professional on stage, and asked that of 15 top working professional comedians with over 230 years of comedy experience. And since you're a fan of the Being Funny podcast, matter of fact, we have for the next 30 days a discount where you can get 30% off just for listening to the show. So look for the link in the notes below. Check out the Funny 15 Masterclass in Stand-Up Comedy and use that link for your discount and you can learn something about stand-up comedy today. Okay, welcome to the show. This is TED Talks Too Much. I am Ted Moss. I'm going to be your host today. And we are broadcasting live from the OK Boomer Studios, mobile style. That's right, I am on the road. Currently, I'm down in Austin, Texas. And I got a hold of a buddy of mine, and he agreed to come in. We're going to have a little chat, find out what's going on with him. So stay tuned. We got a conversation with a guy by the name of Mr. Marcus Olin. And Marcus was on the show once before, and we had a great conversation, and it has been years, so we're going to see what's up with him and what's happened since we talked last. So without further delay, here's Mr. Marcus Olin. How about that? That was much ado about nothing.
I like that. That's production quality right there.
That's the best I can do, man.
Hey, that's better than about 99% of podcasts.
Well, you know what? 99% of podcasts suck.
That's true.
It's like they run out of shit to talk about.
Yeah?
I don't think I ever fucking run out of shit to talk about.
Well, that's the name of the podcast, right? Yeah.
Actually, it's funny because I was doing old friends and comedians, so I did some high school friends, and I was interviewing this gal I had not seen since the mid-1970s.
Oh, wow.
And we talked about a subject, and then I talked so long, she said, "Are you interviewing me or am I interviewing you?" And I said, "Well, do you know what the name of the podcast is? I will fill any gaps because that's how I am."
Nice.
Hey, dude, it's so good to see you. I'm so glad to be here.
I was really surprised when you hit me up. I didn't know you were going to be down here.
Well, I kind of did it, I want to say last minute. I wanted to come down and see the mothership.
Okay.
So that was a big deal. And actually, Billy Reno said, "Hey, remember Marcus is down there?" I'm like, "Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I got to hit up Marcus when I'm down there." I thought, you know, maybe he'll set me up for a show or maybe he'll do the podcast. Or it's just nice to have a connection.
Yeah.
And you've been down here. How long has it been now?
I was doing the math. It is 3+ years in Texas. So me and Genevieve moved to Dallas first. So we were there for about 4 months.
Right.
And we've
been
in Austin almost 3 years. It'll be 3 years in April.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why did you change from Dallas to Austin? Just this is a more happening place for stand-up?
Or? I mean, we went to Dallas just because we were booked down there a little bit. So we went down there during 2020, and then we just decided to stay because there was a lot going on in Dallas. Dallas is a big city, too. So you know, we were in Dallas getting a lot of shows, getting a lot of work. And from there, you know, we moved there because we got a cheap room, got an easy place to live, just moved in real quick. And then after about 2 months in Dallas, we started coming to Austin. And that's when we were like, ooh, this is where we need to be in Austin.
Yeah. So. Well, I looked it up. I mean, there's like a half a dozen to a dozen comedy places in Austin.
I think there's about 12 clubs.
No shit, man.
It's crazy.
That is crazy. Yeah.
It's almost too much.
Yeah. Almost. Well, I don't know. Is it?
Well, here's the thing. Austin, especially compared to Dallas. Dallas is huge, right? Especially
right.
Dallas-Fort Worth, the whole area and stuff like that. But I mean, Austin is only like a million people, and I say only, but like, it's not as big as Houston or
right.
San Antonio is bigger than Austin.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Population wise, it's a little bigger.
So Austin's like, the capital though, right?
Austin is the capital.
All right.
But, it is just slightly smaller, but when you got 12 clubs, it's like, there's only so many people.
Yeah.
So they kind of, sometimes they spread out. The Mothership's always sold out. Cap City, which is like kind of North Austin.
Yeah.
That's kind of the old OG comedy club. They were here before the whole boom happened.
Oh, okay.
Cap City. So they still, you know, they get a lot of big headliners. They do well. And then there's, you know, all the other kind of B clubs everywhere else. And they're all kind of fighting for everyone else. But I mean, you know, on any given night, you can go to a show at any of the other clubs and there'd be 50, 100 people there.
I know. And there seems to be a ton of open mics, too, for people that
a
are
ton.
Starting out.
So
I
many.
Mean, early and late, 11 o'clock at night. I went to your club, the one I think you work at.
Sunset.
Yeah. I went there and did open mic like at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or some fucking thing. That was really weird.
That one's crazy. I told you.
Well, no. It was exactly as bad as you said, but
well,
but it's an open mic and I met some people, so that's cool. I was okay with it. You know?
Well, the thing, you know, people complain about the 4 o'clock open mic and I'm like, where else is there a 4 o'clock open mic?
No shit.
Even in Austin, there's no 4 o'clock mics.
I know.
So it's like,
I know.
People want to complain about, oh, well, there's no one here. It's like, okay, well, first of all, the open mic you're going to go to at 7 also isn't going to have anyone at it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an open mic.
Well, that's,
you know?
And the comedians are standing outside smoking while you're talking to three people and a waiter. You know what I mean?
That's
an open mic.
That's an open mic. So
I get it.
I'm just like, you know, 4 o'clock, it's just like if you got a day where you want to hit a bunch of mics, we just started at 4.
Yeah.
Get that extra rep in.
Yeah.
And just, you know, work on some stuff.
Yeah.
And if you're going to let that ruin your day, then you're not going to make it to the 11 o'clock mark.
Yeah, you're in the wrong industry.
Yeah.
Hey, well, my real question for you, I love that you're wearing your Michigan.
I had to.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Day.
Michigan, man. How cool is that? I know. We could talk a ton about that, but I really want to ask you, why the fuck aren't you famous yet, dude?
Dude, that's a good question.
Because I'm serious. You are one of the funniest people coming out of Detroit.
Thank you.
And your girlfriend, Genevieve, is that right? Genevieve? Hilarious.
Yeah.
You two, I mean, really, really good comedians. Now, I went to Mothership, to Joe Rogan's place.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, it's called the Mothership in Austin, Sunday night. But I saw the headliner that was going to be there all weekend.
Okay.
And you guys are just as strong as anybody on that show, dude.
Thank you.
I mean, honestly, and I think it's a matter of a location and luck. Once you get it to a certain level, and you're at that level, Genevieve is at that level, I think you just got to be at the right place. So, and maybe it's connections. I don't know what the fuck it is.
Well, I think it's connections. It's the right place, right time. And I've been noticing it's a lot of patience, too. Because, like, the people I know who have blown up in Austin, a lot of times, like, it seems like it's overnight, but they've been putting in work for years. You know what I mean? And then something happens.
Yeah, but all the work does, as far as I'm concerned, is gives you a chance to learn how to sound natural with your material, you know, develop your voice just a little bit better. And God knows at your level, you don't have nerves about getting on stage. If you do, they're always the same. So you've adjusted to that. So it's not, hey, I'm worried about getting up. It's not that I'm worried about whether my material is solid. It's not that I don't have my voice. I think, I hate to say this, but I think Cat Williams had some of it right when he said, dude, it's your connections. Look at the people coming up with Joe Rogan. Now, I love Joe Rogan's podcast. I think he's brilliant. As a comedian, he's good. He's not the best, but he's good. But he's also pulling a bunch of people with him that are also good. Not the greatest, but good.
I don't know if Joe Rogan would say he's the best. I think if you asked him, are you the best? I don't think he would say
no,
he's
no,
the best.
No, I don't think so either.
Here's what I will say. I watched him before the Mothership opened. He was doing all the shows at the Vulcan.
Yeah.
And I worked there for 2 years before, you know, Sunset opened and everything. So I watched him do an hour twice a week for 2 years. And I watched him develop it. And when you watch it that much, you know, at some point you get like, oh, I know this joke. You know, I know this joke. I know that joke. I know that joke. But then you start watching the wrinkles he's throwing in. It's like, oh, he's still working on this.
The nuances.
He's adding a little bit here and there. He's moving stuff around and getting ready to film, right? A special.
Yeah.
So, like, being able to watch it, and he's been doing it 30 years. Yeah. So when you watch a guy like that for 2 hours a week, you're like, oh, okay.
I get it.
It's like watching a great quarterback in practice.
Yeah.
Because you're like, oh, this is how you watch the game, and it's like, okay, it's the game. Yeah. But then you watch it in practice, you're like, oh, I see. You're working on something right now.
Right, right.
It's crazy. But, I mean, and on top of that, you know, the guy just works.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got the podcast, he's got shows, he's got his own club now. He's been doing UFC forever. I mean, you know, the money stream he's got coming in, I don't think he even needs to do the comedy. He loves doing comedy.
Well, no. He doesn't need to do anything. He could quit right now he could live on.
But he loves what he does.
Islands forever. Yeah. Well, that's the idea. Mm. Well, you know what? I think it doesn't matter where you are in life. It's not being at the place you're trying to get to. It's enjoying the road on the way. I think of the people that climb Mount Everest. Once they get to the top, what do they spend up there? Like 5 minutes? 10 minutes?
It's cold, I bet.
No, well plus the air is thin and shit. Yeah. I mean, it's about the climb.
Mm.
And you have to enjoy the steps.
Yeah.
And even though you're struggling that time, even if you look back on like going to college, there was a lot of struggle in that, but you enjoyed the experience. It's like, okay, I got done. Yeah, I got my certificate, my diploma, I got my degree. It's not about that. It's about what you went through to get that. And I think comedy, I think entertainment, I think my path, everything is, it's always the same. It turns out it's not being there, it's getting there that's most important.
Dude, I mean, the journey, since we left Detroit by 3.5 years ago, the journey's been crazy. Because it's like, it started out with a buddy of mine. I don't know if you remember Aaron White. He was in Michigan for a little bit.
I don't know. I thought you came down with like, Justin, wasn't it?
Yeah, so it started out, I went to Oklahoma City, because my buddy Aaron, he's from there originally, he was in Michigan for a couple of years,
right?
And he was like, hey, come to OKC, we got a new club open,
we're doing shows.
During COVID, right? He's like, we're doing shows, come down here.
Right.
So I go to Oklahoma City, he was like, hey, I also got us a show in Dallas, it's like 3 hours from OKC.
Yeah.
So we drive to Dallas.
Your voice is kind of coming in and out, pull the mic away from you a little bit.
Oh, away? Okay.
Yeah, away, and right so, there. Yeah, okay, yeah.
So we go to OKC. He books us the show in Dallas. The guy in Dallas loved me. He was like, I'm going to have you come back and headline my show at Hyenas.
Right.
That's the main club in Dallas.
Right.
So I was like, okay, all right, we'll come back in a month or whatever. That's when I came down with Genevieve and Justin.
Right.
And when the day we left from Michigan to come down here to do those shows in Dallas, they shut Michigan down for another 3 weeks. So we were only supposed to be in Dallas for a week.
Right.
And the day we left, we're like, what are we going back? What are we going back to? We're going to go back and sit on our ass for another couple weeks or a couple months.
It sucked.
We said, hey, let's just stay in Dallas. We got an Airbnb for a couple weeks. And then during that time, we met our buddy who got us a room.
Right.
And then we drove back to Michigan, drove back down in the same week, right?
Yeah.
7 days apart, just packed all our stuff, moved down here. And then, so it's like the journey of all of that and the time, you know, if I hadn't have said yes to the Oklahoma City gigs and then I wouldn't have done the Dallas gigs. Had I not done the Dallas gig, I wouldn't have got the other Dallas gigs.
That's always the way.
And
that's
the journey,
the way.
So it was just a crazy journey the entire way through. And, I mean, I feel blessed about it because it's like, otherwise I wouldn't be down here. She wouldn't be doing the things she's done. She's got to go on the road with Tony Hinchcliffe. She's open for Joe Rogan.
Oh, really?
She's done all kinds of crazy
stuff.
Wow,
that's awesome.
Yeah, so and that's the thing. It's like, I know that for both of us, we want to be doing this together as much as we possibly can.
Yeah.
So the fact that she's getting momentum down here, even if I'm not getting as much as she is, I know I'm getting some because I know where I was two, three years ago when we got here.
Right, right.
And, sorry.
That's okay.
And it is the patience part is just like you can't force it, but you can still be working all the time.
Well, you know what? There was a comedian that came up to, do you know One Night Stands?
Yes.
Was that around? Okay. There was a comedian that came up to One Night Stands recently. It was a guy and his opener was his wife and they traveled together and they didn't announce it. I didn't,
right.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
And let's see, it was, I think it was a mixed couple, too. I think it was a mixed race couple, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But so one got up and opened. It was a feature. They, you know, obviously they had a host, and the other got up and did their. And afterwards, we met them. You know, because we're comics, we want to talk to them afterwards. Like, what's up with you guys? And we figured out they were married.
Yeah.
I thought, how cool. You're a couple, and you get to take it on the road together because you're both interested. And they didn't give a shit who was opening or who was doing what.
Mm-hmm.
They were just glad to be on the road, just, you know, doing this journey together.
And that is kind of the dream. We've talked about it. It's like, eventually, whoever gets to the point where they can headline clubs first, the other one is going to open.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so absolutely.
It doesn't
Why not?
Really matter who. And it's kind of like a hedging your bets or, you know, I guess hedging your bets. Diversifying your investments.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all the same concept, right? It's like you can't put all your eggs in one basket.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
For comedy, a lot of times you do got to put, you only have your basket.
Well, you know what? And nobody is successful alone. Whether you hook up with somebody that's famous, that's there, or a club owners, or a promoter, or another comedian, everybody needs somebody to connect with because that's how you get exposure.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, look at Jerry Seinfeld and the guys he took on the road that ended up headlining. I mean, everybody's done this.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter who's who when you start out down the road. I think it's really cool you got somebody to do it with because most of us are doing it alone.
Yeah, I know.
You know?
I did it alone for a while too. And it's like, it's just, it's nice because it's like, you know, we can go do, we're going to do San Antonio. We actually just got booked to do San Antonio for Valentine's Day.
Oh, cool. So they had isn't that where they have the Secret Club or something like
that's
that?
That's Houston.
Oh, that's Houston.
Secret Group, yeah.
Secret Group. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that was
Secret
it.
Group
yeah, yeah.
is really cool. Houston's great. I think the great thing about Austin is, like, you are 3 hours from Houston, 3 hours from Dallas,
right.
which are two of the top biggest cities in America.
Right.
And they have great scenes. San Antonio is a really good comedy scene.
Yeah.
And it's an hour, 2 hours away.
Yeah,
depending on traffic.
We performed there. Billy Reno and I performed there. I think they might have had a podcast that went on before the show where they had a bank of people that and a mic where you could talk into the mic and be on their podcast, and then they had a show afterwards. And I think they might have had a club that was like in the basement of a place that had like statues for kids. I don't even know what it was, but it, you know, I'm talking
the
5 years old.
The Blind Tiger?
Yeah.
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 I love that place.
Yeah, it was very cool.
Because it's like... I asked them one time, how much can you seat in here? Because it's such a small room.
Yeah.
And they were like, I think they told me 50 or 60.
Yeah.
But you get 50 or 60 people in that little basement,
yeah.
it's fun.
Well, that's what you want. You want it packed.
Yeah.
And you want people laughing on top of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd much rather do that than a Mark Ridley's that holds, 400 people and only have 50 people sitting in the front.
You want to do both.
Yeah.
Do them both. You know what I mean? That was the beauty of the Comedy Store back in the day. And, I mean, I know it's still there, but, yeah, I mean, I've been talking to L.A. people all week.
Hey, have you done this store?
I did it in 2019 after the Ridley's contest.
Oh, yeah. And
it was awesome.
Yeah, and they put you in the belly room, I assume? The little room?
I did all three rooms.
Really? How awesome is that?
Yeah, yeah, over the course of the week, I did all three rooms. And the belly room, I mean, the main room is super fun, obviously, 400 people.
Yeah.
The big room.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, the belly room is like, because I like to be quick and pop, 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 pop.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, crowd work, interact.
Sure.
And just get into my jokes and stuff. So the belly room is fantastic for that because it's so small, it's all condensed in there, so that's why I like Blind Tiger. There's a couple other small rooms in Austin. East Austin Comedy Club is a really tiny little room that's similar to that, but yeah, it's, you know, back to what you're talking about, it's like, yeah, it is who you're around, you know what I mean? And that's why, like, when we came down here, we're like, oh, a lot of the people who moved here are like similarly minded, where they're like, I'm here, I moved here, I moved my whole life here to do comedy,
right?
I take this shit seriously,
right?
You know what I mean?
Right
So just being around, that's good. And then, like we were talking about at the top, 12 clubs, there's almost unlimited stage time. There's no excuse to not get it, you know what I mean? I mean, you can always make excuses, but like, there's no legit excuse, like, I don't know where to go. It's like, well,
there's
one here, then you walk a block here, there's another one, you walk here, there's another one,
right?
It's just everywhere,
day in, day out. You know what, the weird thing about doing comedy in a place you've never been before, and I experienced this a lot when we did our tour, because we did, 30 shows in 90 days from coast to coast. If you're good, if you're telling decent jokes, if you actually have some material, after the show, people want to talk to you. Other comics want to talk to you. So it's easy to meet other comics if you're a quality comic. If you're just doing shit, people go, hey, good set, and you walk. It's nothing. But even I played to your place and had to be eight people. Like nobody, but I did some jokes. I did some real jokes. And there was a couple dudes from Michigan.
Yeah,
met a guy by the name of David.
David Cinefani.
Yeah.
He called me because
he's super cool.
Yeah.
He was like from Sterling Heights, I think, or something.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Super nice guy. Had a beer with him, talked for a while. Very nice guy. So.
I love David. Yeah. So me and David watched the game together on Monday with a couple friends.
That's what he said. He said he was in your crew, man.
Yeah.
We were
going to go to Houston, and then we looked at the weather, and we're like, hail, rain, tornado, high winds.
Hail no.
Yeah, well,
hail to the victors.
Hail
no.
To the victors, but we're and we were gonna take my buddy just got a new car, so we were gonna take his car because we all got crappy cars. So we're like, you got a new car, let's take that.
And then you want a car that's paid off if you're pursuing comedy, is what you want.
Well, yeah, then I have that.
Yeah.
But he's got the new car, so it was like, hey, let's take your car 3 hours to Houston.
Yeah.
But then we looked at the hail. I was like, let's not hail up your car. Not like that. He's got a nice plate. We'll go to your house and watch it there.
So, oh, that's cool.
It was fun. It was
Well,
crazy,
let's talk about the game. Let's talk about the team. What did you think about this Michigan? The whole season, the Harbaugh on the side, not on the sidelines, and that the whole messy season and the quality players, man. What the hell? Who has a better team than that?
Clearly nobody. I've been watching Michigan since when I was a kid. We moved to Michigan from Germany when I was 5.
Right.
I didn't speak any English, so I saw the M's everywhere. I thought they stood for Marcus. That's why I became a Michigan fan. Because my dad's a Michigan State guy. He went to State. He's a State guy, right? Genevieve went to State, too. She's a State fan.
Yeah. I have kids at both, so yeah.
The goal was always go to Michigan.
Yeah.
Date someone from Michigan State, right?
Because Michigan State girls are easier.
No.
They aren't quite as smart.
A little better looking.
Yeah. Hey. Well, you think? Yeah, I dated who she was. She was queen of something at Michigan State. Just a gorgeous girl. I can't remember. They had some special... She was elected to some pretty girl thing, but anyhow, long ago. I was impressed. Whatever it was, I told her I thought it was wonderful. I was like, yeah, who knows what it is.
But, yeah, so, I mean, I've been a Michigan fan since then. I mean, I obviously didn't see 97 in the 98 Rose Bowl, Charles Woodson. Didn't see any of that.
Right.
I really remember watching, like, early 2000s Michigan after Tom Brady, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I had seen before, the last couple of years, I'd only seen Michigan beat Ohio State twice. I had only seen us win. I'd never seen us win a Rose Bowl. So the Rose Bowl this year.
Yeah.
I mean, the national championship was fantastic, and that was wild.
Oh, yeah.
Fun. But that Rose Bowl to me was like, remember the movie Miracle when they're talking about the 1980s Olympic team?
Absolutely. Yeah. I watched it again recently.
Right?
Yeah.
The whole movie is about the Russia game. That's the semifinal.
Yeah.
Listen, and then
they
win the gold, and it's like, in the movie.
Yeah, did they play Ukraine or somebody after that, I think, or something like that?
I don't think Ukraine
Romania
was a country.
Romania, I don't know. They played some.
Yeah.
Somebody.
Somebody.
I don't know.
But so that's what, to me, I'm like that. The Rose Bowl was the game.
Yeah.
That was wild.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, the whole sign-stealing thing, it's funny to me because they called it out before the state game, Michigan State game. So it's like, okay, at that point, they hadn't played Penn State, Ohio State. They hadn't played a championship game. They hadn't played any of the Bamas and Washingtons. If those teams should have changed their signs, they did change their signs.
So
it had no impact on the biggest games of the year.
I don't think it should be illegal anyhow. Everybody's trying to steal.
Everyone's doing
it anyway. The object of the game is to figure out what they're doing with how they line up, what personnel they bring in, and the reason they got three different people giving signals on the side is because the other team is watching. They're watching so they can figure out what you're going to do. That's the whole objective.
Yeah.
And that's why people watch film and tape in this formation. I know they do this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all bullshit saying you can't watch the sidelines or film the sideline. It's just bullshit. I don't even get it. Why is that even a fucking rule?
So it was a rule in 94. They said because back then only certain programs would have had the money to send people with cameras.
Bullshit. Well,
Nowadays, it's not a thing. Everyone can do it.
Yeah.
There's 100,000 people with phones.
Yeah, and it's on TV. It's a broadcast somehow. You can get it on the internet. You can get everything.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing. There's total visibility, and everybody's trying to figure out what the fuck you're doing. That's the object to the exercise. That's why we bring in this group of people, because we see what you're doing. That's why we call a timeout right before the big play, because we see what you're doing. I mean, that's the object.
Yeah.
That's the object of the fucking game, is to figure out what your point. It's not like golf where I don't care what you're doing. I care what I'm doing.
Yeah.
In football, it's what the fuck are you doing? Let me figure this out. And what's my best response to it?
Yeah.
So I think it's all bullshit.
Well, I've been saying the whole time, I think Michigan just studied a little harder.
Isn't that the case? Yes.
I'm sorry.
And the guy who went to Ross Business School, you studied a little harder too, man. Yeah.
It was
a little bit harder than most places. Yeah. Yeah. Fuck yeah.
And the other thing is just like, my buddy is a Bama fan. That's the funny thing down here, because everyone's a transplant. No one's really from Austin.
Ah.
There's a lot of Texas fans down here. But, I mean, I know so many more Ohio State fans down here than I ever did back home.
Oh, really?
And I've been an asshole about it ever since we beat them. Since we beat them earlier this year.
Yeah. We beat them again.
Again.
Yes.
Know. But I didn't start working with a lot of these guys till this year. So, like, I have two yellow maize sweatshirts, right? And I've just been rotating them.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, my Bama friend, you know, on that fourth down, he was like, it kind of looked like y'all knew what we were doing.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, you only had one play that worked all game. It was QB up the middle. So I was like, yeah, probably that one.
You think?
And then you snapped it low. Was that our fault?
Yeah, exactly.
And then we blew your tackle into the quarter. Like, did we know that play? Or yeah. Are we better?
So, yeah.
I know we sound like homers to anyone who's not a Michigan fan.
Well, it's a big deal. You know what? It's a big deal, the rivalry between Michigan and Ohio State. And you take Michigan, which is the most winning program in the history of college football? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
High school, pro, college, anything.
Yeah. So it's a big-time program, and there's a huge rivalry to the point where the Ohio State people will not even say the name of Michigan as a school.
Yeah.
They say the school up there. But all that being said, if you don't have decent competition, what's the fucking point?
Right.
You know, you don't want to go play third-rate schools and go, okay, we beat everybody again. Mm. You want people that are tough.
Yeah.
Now, this may not be your position, but my position is this. Once we're out, I will root for the Big Ten team because I'm rooting for our conference to be tough. I want Ohio State to beat Alabama. I don't hate them so bad that I don't want Big Ten to represent. But if you're good enough to beat us, I want you to beat everybody because I want to think we're second place in the nation if you're first place. Now, a lot of people can't do that, and I get the jump.
It's tough to do that. A lot of my Ohio State friends have been like, well, I was rooting for you. One of them said, I was rooting for you the whole time so that you would lose in the national championship.
Oh, fuck.
They're all comments. They're like, what's the funniest way to go about this?
Exactly. How can I be the biggest asshole?
But back to comedy, it's like competition is, there's so much competition in Austin. Because everyone who moved here was like, comedy, but, you know, they're here to do it. There's a lot of funny people down here. And I think comedy needs competition, too. Because if you're not like watching other people like, damn, that guy's crushing it right
now.
Or that, you know, they got, oh my, how did they come up with that? It's so,
yeah.
So when you watch other people, you know, you're not doing it to like emulate their style. You're doing it to be like, this is the new bar.
Right.
If you're on a show with someone, right? It's a showcase, 10 comics or whatever. You're like, you know, you're watching the other comics partially to get a feel for the crowd.
Sure.
But part of that is also like, okay, so that's the new bar.
Right.
You know, you watch the host and the host.
Right.
I always look at a comedy lineup like a baseball lineup, right? Where it's like, you know, you got nine guys. Say, you know, maybe for comedy, maybe you only got the three, right? So you got your host, feature, headliner.
Right.
It's not the host's job to hit a home run.
No.
The leadoff hitter's not supposed to hit home
run. No, he's just setting up the table for it. Yeah.
So anytime a host is like, I don't think I did so good, I'm like, did you get anything? And they're like, yeah, I got him going a little bit. It's like, you got on base.
Yeah.
Maybe you hit a double.
Right.
Sometimes the host hits a home run. That's rare.
Right.
But like, you just got to get on base.
Right.
And you know, sometimes you're going to strike out, but go out swinging.
Right. Right.
I hate
right.
when I watch a comic and it's like, you're not even swinging up there, man.
Yeah.
You got to play appearance and you're just watching strikes and you're not even trying.
Right.
So it's like, you know,
I think you got to play important for the show, and I think the headliner is the headliner.
It's a cleanup hitter.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I went to Big Tommy's in Novi. I don't know if you know Big Tommy's.
I went
to Big Tommy's, and Billy was going to record for his new CD there. Mm. And we had a really good comic, I think Abby Wittengrimer, whatever. But she won the LA Express 1 year. But she she kind of does a weird character that laughs at
her. Yeah.
Okay, so she's really good with the right crowd. Mm-hmm. She had an off night, and she was hosting. She, like, I don't want to say it was silence, but it wasn't her best set. And I've seen her kill.
Yeah.
So it's nothing against her. She just wasn't in tune, and she was the host, and Billy's going to record. And I was the feature. Matter of fact, I had to cancel a gig with somebody else to do it. It was first time I ever did that to anybody, but I said, dude, I gotta go do this for Billy. And I saw there was nothing.
Yeah.
And I wasn't worried about time or anything. I just got to get the audience laughing.
Right.
I got to get everybody going and then say that's my time. Because Billy's got to walk up with something hot because he's recording this.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to try and sell this on a CD. Mm-hmm. So my job as a feature at that point in time isn't to hit a home run.
Right.
It's to get everybody participating, everybody give each other permission to laugh. Because I think there's some of that in comedy.
Oh,
when this table laughs, it gives this table permission to laugh.
It's contagious.
Yeah,
it really
is. And if nobody laughs, they're like, I don't want to be the first one to, you know. So it was my job to engage everyone. And I ended up doing pretty good, got them all set up, and he had a pretty good set. Mm. But I think the object of the exercise is to set up the headliner. That's the star. That's the person who's going to do 45 to 60. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the person they're coming here to see. Everybody else is, it's good practice for us. You know, we can stretch our material, find out what works. But I don't want to go up there and just crush and make it impossible to follow me. Mm. I mean, one of my favorite comics is Mike Ball.
I love Mike Ball.
Hard to follow. He does so much crowd work. And if you aren't a crowd work comic, and some of those rooms, he knows everybody. He went to high school with them. And they're his hometown. Mm. And all of a sudden, they're all engaged and they're all interacting with Mike. And Mike feeds off that. And he's good with that. Mm-hmm. But if you're just doing a set where you're just reciting jokes, really, I mean, behind the scenes, that's what it is.
Right.
I'm going to make it sound conversational, but it's not. I don't want to hear your side of the conversation. Mm. And to foul Mike can be difficult if the crowd gets too out of line. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I love doing crowd work. So when I love doing Mike Ball shows because...
Well, see, you can follow that really well.
And that's where it's also like the style and the pairing.
Right.
Back to the baseball lineup, it's like okay, I want to have a lefty here, and then I want to have a guy with some speed. It's like, you know, when you're making a comedy lineup, you don't want the grossest comic going first.
Right.
The guy who's going to talk about piss and shit in his
butthole and fucking
all that. That guy doesn't go first.
No.
Like on a non-headliner show, right? Just a showcase, right?
Right.
Where everyone's doing the same time. That guy doesn't go first.
Right.
The first guy, maybe if you got a clean comic, you throw him first.
Yeah.
Something just to be like, hey, I'm funny, but I'm not going to gross you out. I'm not going to make people leave. People are—they're not drunk yet, right?
Right.
You got the 2-drink minimum.
But you want somebody with energy, though. You want somebody to get
an energy, though.
Yeah,
too.
You want them to start the show and get everybody engaged.
Deadpan.
Yeah. Right.
Deadpan.
Right.
And it's like so when you're—it's like curating a fucking art museum, right?
Right.
It's like you don't just you got that there and a Picasso, and then we'll do a Van Gogh and whatever.
Right.
It's like this shit doesn't. I feel schizophrenic in this room. This is no, because it's like at a museum, it's like no, this is this time period.
Right.
And then you walk into another room, and it's like, okay, and this is like abstractions and whatever. I'm not an art expert, but I've been to enough museums to get like, no, this room makes sense because it's all kind of the same
same
thing.
Right.
So it's like when you're making a lineup, dude, and this is on the comics too sometimes where it's like, and it pisses me off when comics don't watch each other and you're on the same show.
Right.
Because sometimes you watch a show and it's like, three comics in a row, it's like, oh, are you guys together? It's like the whole crowd, all 50 people or whatever, whoever's there, it could be 1,000, it could be 2 people.
Right.
Everyone in the crowd knows. They've been watching the whole movie.
Yeah.
They know that they're together. They know that, oh, no, they're just brothers. Sometimes you're like, oh, y'all dating? No, that's my sister, brother,
right,
sister.
Right, right, right.
So when you watch 6 comics in a row do the same bad crowd work because no one's watching,
right.
It's bad for the show.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I don't think... Like, I know we talked about competition in comedy, but I think that's just to raise your own level.
I agree.
But you're not competing against the comics on the show.
Right.
You're on the same fucking team. That back to the baseball thing, it's like you're on the team.
Right.
Make the crowd laugh.
Right.
As much as possible, working together, even though you're only up there by yourself.
Right.
But I don't know.
One of the fun things I did was compete in that LA Express competition at Mark Ridley's. And for people who don't know, they have a... it's months long, and the winner, like Marcus, eventually get money to go out to L.A., and they hook him up with some shows. So it's kind of a cool reward for the person who wins. And I was in that 2 years in a row, and I made the finals 2 years in a row. But the cool thing was it meant I got to play to a good crowd about 4 times to get to the finals.
Yeah.
So that was all good. And each step you're performing with better comedians, better show, bigger crowd. So even going through the process is fun. But in the finals, and it's run by Bill Bouchard, who's been around forever, runs a good show, knows what he's doing.
He's awesome.
Yeah, he is awesome. Made me go first in the finals 2 years in a row.
Mm.
And the second time I called him up, I said, dude, I can do math and I can do statistics. Do you know what the odds are if you're pulling out of a bucket that I would go twice out of 12 people or whatever the fuck it was, yeah, 2 years in a row? You know what the odds are? They're astronomical. This is on purpose. And dude, I'm not going to win from number one. They're going to, you know, they're not warmed up yet. They're going to forget tough, me by yeah, the end. It's, yeah. He said, well, I've seen it done. I said, yeah, it's not happening. But I decided not to do the contest anymore. I thought, okay, I'm an old white man. I'm probably not going to win. I'm not going to represent Detroit and L.A. They're just not sending me out. And then I thought about Bill, and I thought, you know what? He's trying to put on a good show. He wants somebody with energy up front that's going to engage people. It's a little bit loud, kind of fast, kind of talky, kind of me. Mm. And that's what he's doing.
That is a part of it, yeah.
Yeah, when you come into the finals, I want everybody to enjoy the show. So I got to have energy up front to get the thing started. And like you said, put the deadpan guys in the middle or whatever. Yeah. And we'll go through that. And then at the end, so he's not just worried about the competition as much as he's worried about producing a good show. So he puts the batting lineup the way it makes sense. I'm going to have this guy open. This guy's going to do cleanup. This in between, this guy is able to bunt. We'll see how that does or whatever.
Yeah.
And everybody, I mean, I had a chance, but just not as good a chance as I wanted, you know. But such is the nature of comedy. And I didn't need him to send me to L.A. I can fly to L.A. if I want to go to fucking L.A. You know, but it would be good to be hooked up on some shows.
Right, right. That, yeah. I think that's more what you're competing for. But, I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, competitions are weird because it is.
It
makes comedy a little weirder than it has to be and than it usually is.
And some people will sit on their hands because they're there for somebody else, too. Yeah, so there's some non-laughter because it's a competition. So.
Yeah, and that's, and I get why they do competitions, and they're not bad. They're not bad for comedy.
Well, if you're just starting, it's a great opportunity. Yeah. It's better than doing an open mic.
Well, I was going to say, so back to the lineup thing. That's why open mics suck. Because it's just, well, who signed up?
Yeah.
It's the order we signed up in.
Exactly.
And for an open mic, no one's going to go curate 40 names. No one's doing that. Yeah. I don't even know 20 of them.
Yeah.
I don't know their style.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, and that's again, that's just what an open mic is. And it's going to be like that. It's never going to change. It shouldn't change. It's just how it, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think the competition down here is good because it does like, oh, that guy's really doing good.
No.
That guy's really crushing. And it's like, okay, so now you watch. And I like to build off the whatever the person before me is talking about.
Right. Because
I do like to riff and crowd work.
Wow, that's cool.
Well, I just.
Most people can't do that.
Well, yeah.
That's a talent. So you should show that off.
I do, yeah. And it's, you know, it's hard sometimes. It depends on what the person before you is doing, what they're talking about.
Yeah.
If it doesn't segue into you at all. But like last night we did a show at Sunset, the 8 o'clock show that we were on. And the guy before me, his name is Mario Tanti, very funny, but he's more deadpan style.
Yeah.
And he even had a joke about it because, you know, earlier in the show, the crowd was a little light. Not light. They were, you know, 20 people, but reserved.
Yeah.
Right? And then a comic went up there, an energy guy, and he got him going. And then Mario went after him. And again, he's not the energy guy, but their energy kind of dropped. And he was like, hey, man, I used to do heroin, so I got the same energy as you guys. And it crushed. And it started. And he started.
That's good, though.
And he stayed in his style.
Yeah, right.
But he addressed what was going on. And then you know, when he brings me up, he segues one of his jokes into how he's bringing in it. And I fed off that. And I did, you know, called back some of the shit he was talking about, and it was just fun.
No, that's great practice, too.
It's riding the wave. For me, it's always been, and I learned that a lot in the black rooms in Detroit, because I would watch whoever the host is, or watch Josh Adams go up and just fucking not do a joke.
Yeah.
Just riff,
talk about the room. Yeah, I know.
For 30 minutes and crush.
I saw him do that at the Log Cabin one night.
Okay.
And you know, a Mexican waiter came out of the kitchen. He did 5 minutes on the Mexicans working in the kitchen. And whatever happens, Josh is talking about.
He's so good.
I know. He's one of these guys. I'm like, dude, why aren't you famous, too? You should. I mean, he said he went out to L.A., and somebody out there said, well, what's your style? And he said, I can't even tell you what my style is. And he said that was the end of that conversation. He said, well, I can't promote. I don't know.
He did me and Justin's old podcast during COVID, and
you aren't doing that anymore.
We started a new podcast.
Oh, because I haven't seen you guys on the air together in a long time. You were a lot at first.
We were,
and I thought maybe you went to different cities or something.
No, we were kind of down here the whole time. It was tough to make it work. We weren't living together. That was part of it.
Yeah,
when you're living with someone, it's like
that's easy. Turn it on. Yeah,
turn it on. You're doing it. Yeah. But we just started probably December 2023. Just about a month or two ago. And it's called the Works Every Time podcast. It took us 3 episodes to come up with a name, but eventually we figured it out.
That's cool. I like that. Works Every Time.
Me and him and our buddy Phil Garcia, who's from Dallas, we met him up there. We basically dragged his ass down here. And not like he didn't want to come.
Right.
But he lives here now. And he grew up Dallas, Fort Worth. He's from Fort Worth, right? And
he
made the move down here with us. And he was like, yeah, you guys showed up in Dallas. And I was like, oh, these guys are serious. Because no one really moves to Dallas for comedy.
Yeah.
No one moves to, you move to New York, LA, now Austin, or sometimes Chicago.
Yeah.
Those are the only places people move for comedy.
Right.
So anywhere else, you're like, the people who are doing comedy, they just are from there.
Well, I was talking to Billy about that because I think in Steve Martin's book or someplace I read, if you want to do comedy, the one thing you should know is you got to go to where the comedy is.
Yes.
I mean, absolutely. You can do comedy for nobody forever and ever. I mean, I think Detroit is a great proving ground.
It's
great place to learn comedy. There's a lot of guys doing it. And I think there's a lot of good medium-level comics. So there's a lot of people to talk to and to hang with and learn about comedy together. But if you're going to do it, do it. If you're going to do it professionally, if you want to make money at it, you got to go where the comedy is.
Unfortunately, Detroit doesn't have a huge industry for comedy.
Yeah.
And the industry, New
York. Why do you think?
The entertainment industry just isn't in Detroit. And maybe it would have been different if Motown had just stayed and the music industry had just kept booming in Detroit like it had been for a long time.
Right.
But I think when the music industry left, I don't think any entertainment was just going to fill that void. Left the void.
Yeah.
And when the music was gone, I don't think, because comedy didn't really start booming till the 80s, right? Like we know it now.
Right.
There was comedy
right.
before that, but like specials and all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
That was really 80s. And I think, I mean, you might know better than me, but I think at that point, Motown was gone pretty much, right?
Yeah.
It was all in LA.
Well, Berry Gordy moved out of town. The thing, what Berry Gordy did is he took the jazz musicians that played in Detroit, and there was a lot of good underground jazz musicians that were willing to work for almost free.
Right.
And I mean, they called themselves the Funk Brothers eventually, but they're the ones that wrote all the Motown music, all of it, 100% of it. It didn't matter if it was Marvin Gaye or Smokey or Supremes. They wrote all that music.
Yeah.
And they were willing, these top level people were willing to get together and create new music off the top of their head anytime for next to nothing. Then he took these young singers that were good, some of them poets, and had great voices, and he'd bring them in, and he'd groom them. He'd teach them how to dress, how to act, how to interview, how to, and at the time, dance on stage while they're performing. So he created this thing just like they were doing, with all the boy groups that want boy bands.
Yeah,
you know, he was creating these groups, and they were creating the music, and it was costing them next to nothing.
Yeah.
But Berry Gordy was making all the money.
I know.
And
I know.
And when the when the people got really good and got hip to that, they're going, I got to sign with a real label, dude.
Yeah.
And so they left him, and eventually he said, well, it's dead here. I got to go. Now, there's still those top musicians that are in Detroit.
Oh,
there's still really good underground music scene in Detroit, and always has been. And,
right.
And
the comedy is, too. I mean, like we're talking about Josh, he's not the only one.
But people don't know how to, the problem with comedy, people don't know how to market it and promote it. That comedians don't have that business knowledge or background to know how to market something. I mean, they put things on Facebook and they tell all the other comedians, hey, I got a show. Well, so fucking what? It's the same people. You're telling the same people that are not going to come to your show. It's not like you're advertising by putting it on Facebook. You got to tell the general public.
Right. But I would say I don't think you can expect every artist, whether it's comedy or something else, to have that skill set.
No, you can't. You can't.
Great artists aren't going to have, Mike Ball's great because he knows all. He knows. Well, he's very well run.
Well, that's
he knows
what he's best at. Guy. You know, he's a good comic, but I think he's even a better promoter. If I had to set him, put him in the slot,
them, but yeah,
I would say
he's one of those few talents.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's got that. He's really good with people. He's really good with broadcasting what's going on and promoting his shows and stuff. And I think he's a natural at that, and not many people are.
And that's what I'm saying. So like, a lot of times the industry needs the talent as much as the talent needs the industry. Is it the same? I don't know, but I do know like. It's like you're saying, you got to go where the comedy is.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, when people went to New York or L.A., it was like, well, that's how you get on TV. Back in the day, it's like, if you get on TV, that's how you make it as a comic. Now you can start selling out dates and stuff like that. Nowadays, I think it's more internet-based and content-based. Well, you can make that anywhere. But at the end of the day, it's like, you can make all the content you want. You need people to be promoting you, too. And that's where, like, you know, Cat Williams talking about Joe Rogan's promoting all these comics. He's promoting comics who are promoting other comics. And it's like, what I like about Austin is it's not the movie industry like L.A.
Right.
New York, I mean, New York has so much other stuff
going on.
They
have the theater and all that stuff in New York.
They got Wall Street. There's so much shit going on there.
Yeah.
It's New York's crazy.
Yeah.
And it's got its own issues. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's 8 million people on a little tiny island.
Right, right.
Fuck that.
Right.
I'd rather be in Austin where I got an email from my apartment that's like, we need to drip our pipes. It's going to get cold this weekend. I looked at the weather. I'm like... It's going to be 70 on Friday, but it might dip below 32 at night.
Yeah.
And I get it.
We're going to be fine. That's because you're from up north. Been there, done that.
Exactly. So it's like, I don't want to fucking, I get New York is a great place to develop too, because that's, I mean, you got to be funny because there's a lot of competition. L.A., man, the people doing comedy in L.A., and you see it when they come to Austin a lot of times. Not all of them. There's funny people from L.A. too, but a lot of them suck.
Yeah,
they come out here and it's like, are you auditioning for a movie or doing stand-up?
Yeah,
you're not getting any laughs.
Right.
Scripted as shit.
Well, no, when I was in L.A., I saw a lot of that. People were just trying to get stage time. There was a beautiful, beautiful girl on stage when I walked into a club out in L.A., and I thought, you don't have any punchlines. You're just up there screaming and looking good.
Yeah.
You're just, what the fuck? This isn't even comedy. I don't even get it.
No. I mean, and that's, so... I do like Austin's very comedy-centered. This is a music town, though. Like, this was a music town before it was a comedy town.
Yeah, okay.
Like,
country music, I assume.
Yeah, mostly, obviously. You know, Willie Nelson and Janis Joplin and some other people. But, like, it's just there's so many stages here.
Yeah.
For a long time, it was the live music capital of the world. That's what they call it, right?
Yeah.
So there's stages everywhere already.
Yeah. Well, actually, when I went upstairs at your club and discovered a stage, I thought, that's a fucking stage. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Kind of nice little room.
Yeah. That's where it's like, and that used to be a music venue. Vulcan used to be a music venue. Creek in the Cave used to be a music venue. The Mothership used to be the Alamo Drafthouse Movie Theater.
Oh, yeah.
And they did a ton of renovations.
That was beautiful. I even like those little booths up in the back.
Were you in the big room or the little room?
I was in the big room. Okay. I peeked into the little room, and actually they were having an open mic. And they let me sneak up there, and I tried to beg some time, and they're like, nah, they weren't having it. I'm like, dude, I came 1,400 miles.
Yeah.
I just want to do 5 minutes. And they actually had people listening. I thought, they'll be surprised because I'll just do my closer in a couple bit. I mean, I will get laughs. I felt confident, but
the Mothership open mic?
Yeah.
That is one of the hardest things to get on.
Really?
Getting stage time at the Mothership is... I mean, I don't know what the most rare resource is in the world right now, but in comedy,
or something,
it's stage time at the Mothership.
Really?
Even the people who work there, it's tough to get
I wanted to
time.
Try and get on Kill Tony, too, but...
Kill Tony, yeah, you could get on Kill Tony.
Yeah, it's only 1 minute,
Kill Tony, I don't know. I'm not going to shit on it.
Well, it's exposure, though.
It's exposure. It's just a weird... thing because it's you do get your minute of stand-up, but that's such a short time. You can get it done. I've had a good set on Kill Tony, and I've seen people crush in a minute, like insane crush.
Yeah,
and it is doable, but it is like it's weird because they just did the New Year's episodes. They did them at a stadium in North Austin, and apparently a lot of the people who got the bucket pulls were like, "This is my first time doing comedy," and it's like, why would you pick your first time to do it at a fucking stadium?
Really?
Meanwhile, there's like 300, 400 other comics who've been doing it 8, 9 years.
If I put my name on that and I put Flint, Michigan next to it, do you think that would help? Do you think people actually... Because who comes from fucking Flint to do comedy? I mean, it's got to be... What the hell is this?
And nobody. Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah. Hey, I've got... I have an idea. Did I ever tell you about $5 funnies?
No.
I don't think so. Okay, I have a revolution for comedy. Okay. I have the way that comedy is going to revive. Now, we've talked about all these cities where comedy is big. But if you think back to the 80s when it was boom, comedy was fucking everywhere. And that's what you want. We would like to revive comedy and have it everywhere in every town. Everybody have venues, people coming out to see comedy. And every little downtown place where there's restaurants and pubs, we want a comedy show in that town, at least on the weekends, if not more, more opportunities. So I know in my business, the only consistent in 30 years of my business was change.
Right.
The market changes, how we address the market, what we offer the market, how we offer the market things evolves over time. And I think everybody I talk to in stand-up comedy is so ingrained in the three-comic show, the 90-minute show, it's hard to tell them, I want you to do something else because it's not worth my time. And so I was listening to Andrew Schultz. Yeah. And actually, Joe Rogan talked about Andrew Schultz. And the question was, Andrew, did you see my new comic special? And he said, yeah, I watched the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw the first 10 minutes of that one. Yeah, because that's what people do. Because of, you know, TikTok and all these other, you know, Instagram, they'll watch a minute or two. But Andrew Schultz decided, look, if I take my special and I divide it up into three-minute clips, people will watch 7 3-minute clips. But if I put a 20-minute clip up, nobody's watching the whole 20 minutes.
Right.
But people will watch this little short clip. And I decided a long time ago, instead of trying to, here's what comics do. They pick a venue where they can do comedy. They pick people that want to be on the show. And then they try and figure out, how do we get the audience to this venue to hear it? I say do it opposite. Find your audience first. The hardest thing to do is to get dad off the couch, get him dressed up and cleaned up. Mama wants to go out. And get him out of the house, in his car, and drive someplace to do something. Yeah. That's the hardest piece. And I thought, where do most people go when they go out? Mama says, are we going out this weekend? Dad says, sure. Where do you want to go? And she said, I like this restaurant. You know, 95 or more percent of people, adults, when they go out to dinner.
Right.
That's what they're doing.
Gotta
and
eat.
There's all these, yeah, there's all these little towns where you have all these little pubs and restaurants. Pick the one you like. We'll do Italian this week. Next week we'll do whatever. And that's where people go. So couples, whether they're young or older, they're going out on the weekend. So you take a city like Brighton, Michigan, where they've got 20 little restaurants sitting in that town. And every weekend, whether Thursday, Friday, Saturday, maybe even Sunday, these places are packed. Meaning thousands and thousands of people are going to that town to eat. And they drive their car down there. They go into a restaurant to eat. And as soon as they walk out of that restaurant, Mama got all dressed up. She wants to go someplace else. She goes, let's walk the street, or let's stop at the park, or let's look at the fountain, or let's go down to this place and have an after-dinner drink. Mama doesn't want to go right home because she spent 2 hours getting ready.
Yeah.
And you just drove her there in the car. You sat there for an hour and 20 minutes, ate, fine. Mama still wants to show off. And Dad's like, I'm over it, but fine, let's do something.
Yeah.
So my idea is to do something called $5 Funny, and it's a 30-minute comedy show with three comics. And the way you do it is you set up a bar someplace, and I found one. It was great. It was a bar with a blacked-out basement that wasn't being used and an empty bar down there where you could serve drinks. And you advertise that you have a 30-minute show on the hour every hour tonight. That means we have a 9 o'clock show, a 10 o'clock show, and an 11 o'clock show, or whatever the times are best for that town. And when people go out to the restaurants, you have the three comics that are on your show hawk on the streets. And you go, look, hand out a card. Hey, you going out to dinner? Come see our show. It's only 30 minutes after the show. Costs $5 to get in. Nobody's saying no to a $5 show because it costs too much. There's going to be a 2-drink minimum. Okay, but we're only seating up to 50 people or 60, 70, a small room. That many people, first come, first serve. And so they go, okay, we know there's a show starting at 10 o'clock. We better get there at 9:45. Mom and dad walk in for the show. What do? Before they go downstairs to the show, because the velvet rope's up, can't go down yet, they buy a drink. When they walk in, they have to have a full drink to take their seat. If they have a half drink, you got to get another drink. Here's a bar, buy another drink. To sit down, you actually have to have a drink. You don't need a wait staff at this thing because they walk in with their drinks. They take their seats. You need a busboy to clean up. You do a 30-minute show. You got 30 minutes to reset. When the people are leaving the venue, during the show, you introduce by a microphone that's remote by the showrunner. And the first comedian introduces the second comedian, who also has a portable mic, and they pass in the aisle as they banter back and forth, taking the stage.
Okay.
Now, they only got to do like 7 minutes. I've got 50 comics that can do 7 minutes in a heartbeat. They're going to do 3 shows tonight. You ask them to do the same 7 minutes. You know why? Because you want them to come back next week, do the same room, and you divide up the money this way. Every comic gets 20% of all the money. And the guy, the showrunner gets 20%, and the show producer gets 20%. So if I produce and sell the tickets and work the door and work the sound system, I'm getting 40%. If I'm not there and somebody else is running it, and that guy has to be a comic, because if somebody doesn't show up, that guy's got to fill.
That's smart.
And yeah, okay. And so you got $5 to get in, and you also, while they're going out, you have an announcement. Hey, thanks for coming to $5 Funnies. You're probably wondering how we can afford to do this. Well, we really can't. We're living off the tips. And yeah, the comics line up in a big tip jar right in front of the door as they're walking out. We hope you leave a tip and support stand-up comedy. Thanks for coming out. See you next time you come down. And also, you will do a shout-out to whatever restaurant is sponsoring you. So you go to a local restaurant and say, we will have a live comic stand on stage and promote your restaurant at the end of the set. By the way, next time you're in town, check out Joey's Italian Restaurant. If you do, we'll do that. And all you got to do is every check you give out, every bill you give out to your customers, give them one of our cards and tell them about $5 Funnies. So you got the restaurants. You got the restaurants promoting your show just for a shout out at the end of the show by a live comic. You got the comics shaking hands as everybody leaves the venue. It's only been 30 minutes. It takes 5 minutes, 6 minutes. And then you reset the room, and the comics can hand out more cards on the street. You give them 12 cards for the weekend. You know, hand them out tonight. You can have more if you want. But you're getting 20% of the profit. So if you figure you get, say you fill it out. Say you got 50 people, you fill out 3 shows a night, 150 people a night at $10 a person, that's $1,500 a night times 3 nights, that's $4,500. And comics for doing 8 minutes are going to get 20% of $4,500. It's a lot of money for doing very small, short sets. But this...
Is that $900?
What's that?
20% of 4,500. That's 900 bucks, right? Jesus Christ.
Yeah, for doing 8 minute sets. Now you got to do 3 of them. That's if the room's packed. But even if it's 20 people at a show, that's 3 shows, 20 people, that's 60 people times 3 nights, 180 people at $10 a head, that's $1,800. You know, you're getting 20% of that for doing 8 minute sets. And everybody can do a solid 8 minute sets. It means you can make a living and not even leave town. But what you got to do is you got to set it up in a town that has a bunch of restaurants. You got to have the comics show up and say, look, if you don't show up a half an hour ahead of time and check in, you're not getting 20% tonight. Because I'm going to put you on the street for 15 minutes handing out cards. And every card's going to say, just a 30-minute show. And you have a countdown clock up on the stage. And they can see it's counting down. So they know they're going to have their drink. Mama's going to get to do something after she goes out to dinner. And it's not going to be a 90-minute show. It doesn't have to be the main event. They're going to listen to funny people. And everybody can be fucking funny for 8 minutes.
Yeah.
And you could do this all over the country. At all, any place that has a whole bunch of restaurants, have this 30-minute comedy show. Because I tell you what, I love comedy, and I'm bored at a 90-minute show. After about an hour, I've had enough comedy.
Sure.
So, but I think the new way of receiving comedy and funny things are in these 3 minutes, 5 minute clips, or 2 minute clips, or 1 minute clips that you're getting on Instagram. So having funny shit you can say really fast is good, and you can banter with each other while you're going, you know what? And you have a countdown clock, and I figured I would do it by taking a deck of cards. a different color deck for each show, you know, or a different back. And you buy a ticket to the show, here's your thing. But you got to be on premise, you know, to get a card. Are you going to stay here? Because you're buying a drink from the guy. So this guy is going to get 150 people a night, or maybe 80 people a night, that weren't going to come into his restaurant, guaranteed two drinks.
Right. And,
you know, what is he making? $3 a drink time two drinks time. I mean, it's a lot of money for the guy that puts the thing on. Mm. It's a real simple show to do. All you got to do is get the comics to understand, look, it's different. You're going to do 8 minutes, solid eight. And that, believe it or not, I want you to do the same fucking 8 minutes tonight, tomorrow. You're going to do it 12 times. You're going to practice that fucking 8 minutes. And if you do that, I can bring you back next week to do a different eight. Now, if you want to do crowd work, that's fine, because that's all original. And I'm good with that.
Well, my question was, what about the people who want to stay for the second and third shows?
Well, it's the same show. You haven't seen it.
People will stay, though.
Well, no. We're kicking you out.
Oh, you're not going to let them stay.
No. Well, okay. The nice thing about, unlike music, where people can hang around, comedy, you can ask them to leave.
Right.
You don't have to go home, but you got to vacate the room. We got to reset for our next show. Thanks for coming. Most of the people are going to go home, because most people went out to dinner tonight.
Yeah.
You know, most people aren't there for comedy. They're in town to see the show. And this is instead of getting an ice cream cone or just sitting having a drink at a different bar. It's kind of like when you go to Vegas and you get tired of the gambling and you go in one of those little showcase rooms and see the dancers for, you know, 20 minutes. The object of the exercise is to sell you two drinks and get you back on the gambling floor.
Right.
The object of this exercise is make you laugh really fast, get you the hell out, and get the next group in. And hopefully there's going to be people waiting to get in, because if they're waiting to get in, they're buying drinks, and that helps the owner of the club.
Mm.
So my feeling is it'd be easy to do. You'd have an unlimited supply of comics that can do 8 minutes or five, whatever. It'd be fun to banter with each other. And where is a new average comic going to make that kind of money and can come back and do it every month?
Yeah.
It isn't like a club where you're going to do it three times a year or twice a year. It's like, dude, you can do this every month.
Yeah.
Because we don't care who's on.
I know I've seen people who will sit through an hour and a half show and then be like, oh, y'all got another show? We can stay for free for the next show?
Oh, yeah.
There are psychos out there.
Yeah,
like
but
that.
I'm not building the show for that, dude.
Don't build it for the psychos. But, I mean, I like the shorter show stuff.
I think you got to rethink comedy. Actually, I was talking to Mike Green, and I think Mike said when he was out in Vegas, he was doing one-hour shows.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's interesting. You don't have to have a 90-minute show.
45 minutes, too. I mean, a half hour is you pop, 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 pop.
Yeah.
But I think, because I've noticed.
Well, the other thing is, if you end up with only two comics, everybody can do 15.
Right.
You know, it's fine, 15, and y'all get, instead of getting 20%, y'all get 25% of whatever we bring in.
Well, my thing would be, if they're not showing up, they're off the roster.
Yeah.
If you're gonna have it based so hard on the comics and they're barking and they're out there promoting and stuff like that, if you're not going to show up to this shit, I'm not booking you again.
Yeah, well, the other thing, I bought a big sandwich board to do this. I actually got a bar to do this, and I'm going to put a sandwich board on the street, Comedy Tonight at these three times. We're going to put a thing on the window that so everybody knows all week we have comedy at 9, 10, you know, 30-minute show. And it's important you tell them it's just a 30-minute show. Because then people go, oh, and first come, first serve, limited seating. Because you want them to come early and you want them to pack out. But if you got 1,300 people in the city going to dinner, I don't think it's going to be hard to get 50 people to sit in a fucking 30-minute comedy show
if
after dinner.
If you got foot traffic, you can do that very well.
Well, that's what you have in these little towns.
Yeah.
That's what you have. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's Knoxville, Tennessee, or if it's Ann Arbor, or if it's Brighton, Michigan. You got these towns with all these little restaurants, all these little pubs, and they're all getting, you know, 1/10 of the people that come downtown to eat at their place. And you're going to advertise to all these people. And it's good for all the restaurants, too. It's an add-on for all the restaurants. And if you're willing to advertise for them, I can't believe that they wouldn't hand out your cards. Like, by the way, if you're done, they got a show. And it's not one time every night. It's like, oh, there's three shows and it's only 30 minutes. Yeah, let's go have a laugh and a drink.
If you can make it work, because I know a lot of venues that here, and here's the biggest problem with like a lot of young comics when they try to produce the show. They'll get a venue. The venue will be like, yeah, we'll do a show. They'll do the show. The show will suck.
Yeah.
And that venue will be like, we're done with comedy. So even if a more experienced producer or someone else tries to come in and go like, hey, you guys have a great room. I would love to do comedy here. Your location's great. I have a business plan and everything. That business will be like, well, last time we did comedy, it sucked.
Yeah. Well, in this case.
And this is different, but it's like.
But because I'm paying so much money. I got Bill Bouchard to drive to Jackson, Michigan for $200. So if I tell Bill Bouchard, by the way, you're going to be making $900 or somewhere between $500 and $900. Will you come to? Hell yeah, he's going to show up. I mean, I could get all headliners to do this show. All the Detroit headliners would line up to do this show. You know why? Because if they aren't on the road, they can do it again next month because they're only doing 8 minutes of material.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a great backup plan when I'm not on the road, when I'm not booked. I'm going to give Ted a call, see if I can get into his show because I'm going to make solid money doing it. And they don't have to practice. They don't have to worry about their set. It's like, yeah, I know.
Yeah, I'm just going to do 8 minutes.
I'm going to do these two bits. I'm going to say hello, then I'm going to do these two bits, and I'm out. You know?
That's funny to me that you're like 8 minutes, two bits, because I go 8 minutes, eight bits.
Well,
you know what I mean? But yeah. It's so funny because when I write with other people or even with Genevieve too, right? We'll be walking out set lists and we'll be going through stuff and I'll be like, you know, every bullet point I write, I'm like, that's a minute. That's a minute, a minute, a minute.
I
do probably write shorter jokes, but it is fun. And I don't know if I do that because of the short attention span that you're talking about either.
Yeah.
Because it is like, I mean, I know what you're talking about where people, it's like, I'm one of the few people, I'll watch a whole special, but I'm different. I'll watch, I watched a 40 minute compilation of, I think that's another problem with producing is like a lot of people produce how they would want to see it. It's like, but you're a comic. How does the general public
view
this?
Well, that's the general public is getting comedy by their friends sending them. Look at this TikTok.
Look at this
1 minute, listen to this 3 minute thing. That's how the general public understands and receives comedy. Mm. And if you're really trying to address your customer, you have to realize your customer is different now than they were in the 1980s.
Different than 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they aren't shocked when you say fuck or pussy on stage. Mm. You don't get that shock laugh anymore because everybody's heard everything. The exposure's real high. But also, the weird thing about seeing even long comedy specials on Netflix or whatever, you know as well as I do, that's not the set they did. That's three sets combined.
Three sets.
And it wasn't all there because comedy for 90 minutes isn't hilarious. There's some talking that goes on in that, you know. Now, the other side of that, like you were saying, I remember I did and I think it was a competition over in Grand Rapids, and I was with a new girl that came from improv. And she was so raw. I thought, this girl cannot be funny. But she asked for a ride, and we had time to talk on the way over, and we had to do like 8 minutes. And I said, well, tell me, how many punchlines, how many jokes do you have in your 8 minute set? And she said, four. I thought, holy fuck, four. You're going to talk for 2 months.
Four punchlines?
Yeah, you're going to talk Jesus. 2 minutes and then hope they laugh at this. I thought, oh, that's terrible. She said, how many do you have? And I said, 56. I said, you know, now maybe 56. Only 20 of them will hit. Maybe only 20 will hit, but that's still.
So it's 7 a minute?
Yeah, well, see, you do the setup and then you do punchline, tag, tag, tag. You know what I mean? So and sometimes it's just a pause and a look. That's an I expect to laugh there because I'm looking like I'm confused.
But 7 laughs a minute's pretty good.
Yeah, well, you're trying to get one every 15 seconds successfully.
Well, that's about every, that's less than every 10 seconds.
Well,
Well, and the thing about it, too, is like, because sometimes I'll go back and listen to a set and I'll be like, you are getting your 6, 7, 8 laughs.
Yeah.
But sometimes it'll be like, there'll be 20 seconds of where you're not getting the laugh, and then you get the laugh, and then within the next 10 seconds,
you ride the laugh.
You get 6 laughs in 10 seconds.
Yes. Well, those are the tags, and those are, and sometimes the tag's just a look. Sometimes it's a shrug or whatever, but I counted that. Yeah, these are the places I expect. If I hit every one, I'm going to get 56. Mm. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to hit 20 of them. But in 8 minutes, 20 is good. I can live with 20. What I can't live with is 4. And we've all had those sets where you come off and people go, good set. Really, you did good. And you go, dude, it's not my expectation because I've heard this set before and there's more laughter that should have came out. My timing was off or I wasn't with them or whatever. So I think there is something to be said for saying things funny and fast. I think you would be great in a 30-minute show, dude. I think you would kill for 8 minutes. And if I said, look,
I'd kill for 30 minutes.
Well, no, you would. You're a good comic. But also, I think the money is right where it'd be worth your while to go. And I think, okay, I did a feature set at One Night Stands here a while back. And I'm not knocking them at Great Club, and I'm sure they pay just about what everybody else does.
I love One Night Stands.
Yeah, I do too, and I like the crew, I like the owner, I like everybody on the show, but they paid, can I say how much they paid?
It's your podcast.
They paid, so once I figured out how much money they paid me for going to four shows, because there was two on Saturday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, two on Saturday. And I was feature. I wasn't the host. I was a feature, so I was second best paid. I was making less than the wait staff. I was making less than the bartender.
Yeah.
And I thought, hold it. Nobody's coming here to interact with the wait staff or the bartenders. They're coming here because you're selling me and my talent. Not that I'm a great, but that's what you're selling. That's the draw. The draw is the comedy. And even though I'm not a name, that's what they're coming for. And I should be making more money. And I've kind of gotten to a point of it's not going to change my life if I don't get that amount of money. You know, if I don't get paid like a waiter for three nights of my life. I'm not going to buy a new chair. I'm not going to go on a vacation. I mean, honestly, at my age, I'm not really trying to do anything other than enjoy what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And so I'm going, how much do I want to invest in this? And Billy used to get on me and go, you don't do enough open mics. I was like, dude, I'm not afraid to get on stage. And I think that's what open mics is about, getting used to walking up and saying, hey, I'm talking in the mic. And I did that for 30 years. I have no problem walking out on stage and saying, and, you know, I'm not sure my voice is going to change. Mm. My performance is B rated. I'm not the best. And I'm not a great comic. I have good material. I think I write better than most. I perform average to good, and my voice is, you know, my voice is pretty mediocre, but, and I'm not challenged by doing it. Somebody says, hey, go do some comedy. Okay. If it's the right, I'm not doing it in your backyard. This girl asked me to come do her backyard, and I said, yeah, I don't think I'm doing that.
I did a backyard show with Mike Ball during COVID, and I will say the money was good.
Was it?
And the guy who was, it was at his house. He had a private lake he had dug out with a fucking thing, you know what I mean? And he gave us a bunch of weed that he was growing. He gave us. It was crazy.
That's good.
And he paid us on top of what Mike paid us. Mike always pays me well.
Yeah.
The guy paid us more, and then he gave us free stuff.
Oh, well, see. All right. That's good.
Not always the case with a backyard show.
Yeah.
I get that. But yeah. I do want to say this. You are more honest about your own comedy than most of the people I know down here. Because you're talking about, like, you come off stage and people are like, good job. And you're like, nah, that's not what I, you know, I only got 20 out of 56.
Well, as a comic, you know, whether you want to admit it or not, you know when you hit it and you know when you missed it.
But there are so many, and I don't want to say so many, there's a lot of comics down here, and I'm LA a lot because that's a terrible place.
Yeah.
But they'll get off stage and they'll be like smiling. And my buddy Tim Warner points this out all the time. He's a New York guy. He's fucking hilarious. He's been doing it 13 years. He always points out, like, why are you smiling right now?
Yeah,
we all just watched that. You should be fucking
embarrassed.
Yeah, you should be embarrassed.
Yeah, you should have a stomach ache as you go home. Yeah,
and it's unfortunate because that's the LA culture that came to Austin. LA, it's kind of an amalgamation of Austin or of LA and New York and other stuff too. And everyone else who came here, people from Tennessee, the Michigan people, the Florida people who came here. But like that LA mentality of like, you walk off stage and you don't even care that it went poorly because you're in the green room hanging out and buddy-buddy and elbow.
No, that's not the deal, dude. That's not how you get better.
It's not how you get better. And eventually, you know, networking can get you places.
Yeah.
But eventually, the person you networked with who puts you on the show is going to see you.
And their ass is on the line, too. Yeah, they're vouching for you.
Ooh, and the last thing, that's why I get nervous vouching for people because sometimes it's like, I don't fucking know. And I also get nervous when people vouch for me because I'm like, their reputation's on the line with how I fucking do right now.
Right, right.
And that's why, but when you're talking about being like critical of yourself, man, it's like, I know Bill Burr's talked about that too, where he's like, you know, he had a story where he was in the main room or whatever, at the store, and you know, he was, I guess he was like crushing in the middle, and then it kind of, you know,
yeah, fell off. Yeah.
So someone after came up to him and was like, "Hey, man, I walked in for a little. You were crushing." And Billboard goes, "Ah, you're fucking at the end."
Yeah.
So it's like, I have that same mentality, and I've always had it where it's just like not good enough for me.
Yeah,
and I'm the only one I'm trying to impress.
Well, you know what? People don't like that negativity. I'll tell you.
I'm negative as shit.
That's what we love about you. Hey, did I tell you that I coached my daughter in golf? Might have a long time ago. She became a nationally ranked golfer. She shot a 69 in high school, played in college. She was the best NC2A putter in her final year of college, averaged 27 putts around, had one round with 24. She was just a fantastic golfer. But
27 putts around on 18 holes.
Well, she did one round with 24 putts. That means she one putted all but six holes. She two putted.
What the hell?
Well, yeah, her senior year, and they play from the whites, but her senior year, if she missed the green in regulation, she chipped in one putt. It still saved par 74% of the time. If she missed the green and was in the bunker, she chipped in one putted 65% of the time.
So crazy.
Well, she was very talented.
Yeah.
But here,
I have been playing more golf down here.
Oh, have you?
It's a golf. Great golf town.
You know what? She's the director of instruction at Topgolf up in Detroit now.
Nice.
Yeah. But in any case, what I want to get to was we had to take her from her first 18 holes right before she started high school in ninth grade to one of the top 500 in the world, really, because that's where they draw from for college scholarships, in 2.5 years. We had 2.5 years to go from first 18 holes. Now, she had played 9 holes, but first 18 was 2 weeks before high school to one of the top. So I quit golfing completely. And I used to golf 5 days a week at one time in my life. But I said, I can't coach you and be hitting a ball. We're going to spend most time on the range, and when we play, I'm walking with you, and we're talking all the way from this to the next shot about what do you think the wind is, how the ball's lying down, are you going to hit and run, are you going to, you know, which shot are you going to hit? You can play left to right, right to left. What are you going to, you know, all this shit and the rules of golf. There's just a lot to learn when you're learning. But the three basics to be successful, and it's the three basics in business and everything, is one. You need some God-given talents. You need to be gifted with some ability that not everybody has. And if you, I don't care if it's comedy or golf, you need some God-given ability, some voice, some perceptions that just were given to you. Two, you have to be more driven than anybody you know. That means if you got to be able to beat everybody you know at golf and still be willing to go out and practice for 4 hours. That which is crazy in the fact that you're going to spend most of your time practicing, not performing. You get to perform on the weekend in this tournament, maybe, you know, 5 hours this day, 4 hours that day, but you're going to spend 40 hours practicing that. And three, you have to be coachable.
Yes.
Once you think you got it, you're done. You're not growing anymore. And what I used to do is every time she played in every single tournament, I wrote down every shot on every hole that took par away, whether it was a chip shot, whether it was a drive, whether it was a putt. And then when we got done, we would analyze that particular shot. And one time she said, "Dad, can't you just talk about the good things?" I said, "The good things are a given. If you want to get better, we got to talk about all the misses." Now, was that miss because you did something physically wrong, that you didn't quite flush the shot, you didn't hit the shot you meant to, or was that a bad decision? And we found out when she was shooting in the low 80s and we're trying to get her into the 70s, that 75% of her mistakes were bad decisions.
Yeah.
Like, look at on that shot, you have to hit to the position that gives you the most clearance for error. If you fade a little bit, you're still okay. If you draw a little bit, you're still okay. If you top it a little bit or hit it long, you're still okay. If you skinny up next to that pond, if you happen to fade, you've just cost yourself a couple of shots. So that was a bad decision. Or you just hit the wrong club. You didn't take into account the wind. Or you had to hit with each one of her clubs, she had 6 shots. She had a fade and a draw and a straight, and she had high or low. So which of the 6 shots were you trying to hit? You know, you decided to hit a high shot. There's too much wind up there, babe. You had to hit a pitch and run. Or you were hitting in the deep out of the deep grass, which is going to release. If you're hitting off the fairway, it's going to check and spin. So you made a bad decision. So the nice thing is, even with comedy, You have to look at the mistakes. You have to have those bad things happen. You never get better by beating somebody. Michigan's team is not any better because they won this last game. Mm. If they would have lost it, like the Lions, yeah. We got some things to work on.
That Cowboys game.
Yeah, we got some things to work on.
Motivation, too.
Yes, but you know, look, if this comes up next time, let's make that decision instead of this decision.
Like kick extra point.
Yeah, no, yeah, sorry, like five. Oh, when you're on the seven. When you're on the seven, let's go to overtime, yeah, maybe. Yeah. But those three things, you know, God given talent, more drive than anybody you know, and coachability, mm-hmm. you know, willing to look at the bad and figure out how to get good out of it. Now, if you want to be world class, you gotta be 99th percentile. In all but one of those. You can be 95th in one. You can be a little bit lower.
Yeah.
But the people that are really good have all three of those at a very, very, very high level.
Mm.
And they're working at it every day. And you work at it not by praising yourself for what you did mediocre or good.
Yeah.
You work at it by going, eh, I kind of fucked that up. Is the material bad? Was the delivery bad? Was my timing bad? And you can't blame the room. You can't blame the crowd because you only control you.
Yeah. And that's why I like, and last night, you know, I had recorded my set, and I, like I said, I had fun, you know, I riffed off the guy before me, and I was having fun, and there were moments that were good, and but I'm listening back to that, because I had written a set list with some jokes in it, right? It was like, I want to do a couple of these jokes. One of them was a new joke that I was like, I want to work on this joke.
Yeah, yeah.
I got a couple, you know, not really old jokes, but more established jokes that I've written in the past year or so. And then the riffs in there, right? So I go back, and on the drive home, I listen to it, right? Because I was like, you know, I get in my car, turn on my speaker or whatever, and I was like, eh, what, you know, I go on Spotify. Like, what do I want to listen to? But, like, as I went to that app, the voice recording app was there. I was like, I got a 15-minute drive. It was an 8-minute set.
Might as well, yeah.
I might as well spend half the time listening to this, yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. So I put it on, and I'm listening to it, and I'm driving and stuff. And I'm like, okay, so there's moments here where it's like, okay, this is good. And then because I riff so much, it's kind of was, and I'm not in any way comparing myself to Joe Rogan, but when I'm watching him and he's like, oh shit, I think I know how this joke goes because I've heard it every day for the past 2 years or whatever, right?
Right.
And then he throws something in there.
Right.
It's like the audience is laughing because the structure of the joke's already good enough for them.
Right, right.
He wants it to be good enough for him. And I'm watching it, and I'm like, dude, you just misdirected me, and I thought I knew this joke. It's like you're watching a different version of the same movie.
Right.
Whoa, I didn't remember this
scene. Right. Yeah.
It's a deleted scene. Where the fuck did this come from?
Right, right.
So I'm going back, and there's this one joke I've been doing maybe a year or two now, and just recently I just spin on it. Just some
little
shit.
Twist.
And
little twist.
I don't
twist.
Even know where it came from.
Yeah.
But then you listen to it, you're like, and that's in there now.
Yeah.
That's in there now.
Yeah.
Because it works, and I like it. And at the end of the day, you got to talk about what you like. You got to, if it's not funny to you, why are you?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
That's the number one thing Josh Adams told me. He was like, don't go up there and be like, what do they think? Do they think this is going to be, what do they want to hear? What do they?
Yeah.
They don't know what's funny. You are there to tell them what's funny.
Oh.
And if the joke doesn't work, that means you did a bad job of explaining why it's funny. If you told it, you thought it was clearly something about it was funny to you.
Right.
And if they didn't laugh, that's on you because you didn't communicate the funny well enough. But
isn't
it's like, it's your job to tell them what's funny.
Yeah.
You're the comic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like, so I'm listening to that set last night and I'm just like, okay, yeah, that little thing right there. I'm gonna do something with that, right? And then, I mean, you know my weed whacking joke, right?
Yeah, yeah.
One of my oldest jokes.
Yeah.
Yesterday I was like, I added two more tags to it.
Isn't that
just
funny?
Out of fucking nowhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what? One of my jokes, it's kind of weird when you're performing because you're multi-mind. Mm. Like you're thinking about your joke and you're telling your joke and you almost have to stay into it. You can't start thinking too much about the audience or what's going on because you'll lose track. So you have this one mind that's really driving the truck. You're really here. The comedy truck's going down the road and you're just driving this thing. But you're also have this other mind where you're kind of watching yourself while you drive it. And in a pause, sometimes your comedy mind will just blurt out something and you go, oh, that was hilarious. I got to say that every time.
Yeah.
Like you didn't even know you can add. You weren't planning on adding to that joke. Mm-hmm. You know, or it's a lot of times I do this when I take the stage. The room is so odd. I say something about the room and I think, yeah, I wonder what the black people are doing tonight to an all-white crowd. And they fucking laugh. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, a tiki torch, whatever. Yeah, and they go, oh, that's kind of a good opener, you know.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you have more material. And it comes out of practice, you know, mm-hmm. but you need an audience really to kind of help you with things. Kind of, was that funny? Did that hit? Was the timing good? Was it, you know, could people relate to that? I mean, I've seen people go up and tell good jokes in the wrong town and it was unrelatable.
Right.
You know, I we had a really smart Jewish kid and he came up to, did you ever do a Bonto room? Up in Flint?
I did not, no.
Okay, it's a Flint crowd.
Yeah, I know him,
So you can imagine a Flint crowd. You know, mm-hmm. you're just your industrial working class people. And I grew up there, so I usually do well because that's my home. That's where I came. Yeah. So I kind of understand them, and I understand their sensibilities. Well, he was kind of a rich kid, and he was out of Birmingham or someplace, which is a well-to-do suburb of Detroit. And he got up and he did a couple good jokes, but then he got into all these Jewish reference jokes. And these people don't know Jews. I mean, there's probably two in the whole town. Mm. And he was doing all these references they didn't understand. And he was a little bit too smart for them. And he just wasn't reading the crowd, and he just kind of continued on. Well, the weird thing was he was not on the show. He wanted to be on the show, but he was brand new. He came in, and Bonto was going to put him on. And I talked to the kid, and I said, dude, give him 3 minutes. You know, just what the heck? Give the kid a break. You know, you're missing the comic anyhow. I mean, I'll fill as much. I'll give up some of my time. I'll fill what you want and, you know, cut him a break. And he went up and did this time, and he did real good for the first 30 seconds. Mm. And then he just kind of bombed out for the rest of the 3 minutes and had no laughs walking off the stage.
That's like golf, too. You hit a good tee shot and the rest of the hole is shit.
Well, you know what?
That's how it goes. Yeah. You hit the best drive of the day, and then it's like, shank,
yeah, exactly.
Three putt.
Yeah, exactly. And so when he came off stage, I said, do you want a little feedback? Because he was brand new. Yeah, I mean, he was the first year.
Yeah.
He said, yeah. And so I gave him some feedback about, you know, reading the room and what was going on and, you know, you got to understand where you're at and la, la, la. And he wanted to argue about it. And I said, you know what? Good luck.
Yeah.
Like, I'm the one that begged to get you on the show. I've been around for enough years where I can, you know, I'm not perfect, but I can see what you're doing, dude, and what you're not doing. You ought to think about these things. And I was trying to be nice to him, especially because his mom was there, and she was cute, and she was single. So I was one of those things. Well, you know, that's still there. So, yeah, I can't help it, dude. So, anyhow, Live and learn.
I love that you brought golf up because, like, I've been playing with mostly comics around here too. And it's
how good are you?
I mean, I think I'm an 18 handicap. Nothing great.
Yeah,
I shot an 85 this summer. It was fun. That's,
so 85 is good for you.
85 is fantastic.
Oh,
for
okay,
me.
Cool. Yeah, yeah, cool.
I'm not good. I'm not good.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, for casual. And I mean, I know. You know. I know some golfers who are better. I know like a couple 10 handicap or something like that. You know what I mean? Yeah. What is your handicap?
Well, it's an index, but I don't want to be too technical.
I looked in, it's crazy.
Yeah, it depends on where you're golfing. When I was golfing a lot, I was a 6 or 7.
Yeah,
okay, now, that's really good. Now, my daughter's like a 1.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Basically
I mean,
she just scratch golfer.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. But it the weird thing is about golf is, and maybe it's true about comedy too, the better you get, the harder it is to improve.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you're shooting 100, it's not that hard to get to 95.
Yeah.
A little bit more difficult to get to 90. And to break 90, now you're doing something. So every step of the way, there's these quantum leaps.
Right.
Where you figure something out. You know what? I got to rebuild the swing. Like, I got, when I was a member of a private golf club, and we used to golf all the time, average guy was a 14. And sure. I got to a place where I was shooting mid to high 80s all the time, and I was playing a fade. I was always spinning the ball. I was always short, and it was going to the right, mm-hmm. and I was having to work around that.
Yeah.
And I quit golfing for about 5 weeks. And when you're golfing 5 days a week, that's a lot of quit.
Yeah.
And I went to the range, and I started by hitting balls 20 yards. I said, I'm not gonna fade. I'm gonna get the swing plane right. Mm. And what I discovered was golf is like ping pong. That is, if you ever play ping pong, you can spin the ball by moving the paddle from left to right or right to left, and it causes the way the ball spins in the air and the way it curves. And the same thing is true with golf. So I was spinning everything to right, and they call that being over the top. But basically, when the club face comes in contact with the ball, instead of hitting it square, you're hitting with a glancing blow across it, putting that side spin on the ball. So I worked and worked until I learned how to hit a draw. So then I had a straight ball, a draw, and a fade. Now, the draw is what you hit off the tee, because the draws will hit and run. The fades will stop. And so I became more strategic. And that's when I got into the 70s, when I was able to go out. And by the end, my typical round was somewhere between, almost every time I was shooting between 76, 77, and maybe top 82. But it was that every single time.
Yeah.
You know, you go out, and you, depending on the weather, a couple of bad shots, missed a putt, you know. And that's where you're at, because it just becomes harder and harder. And like when I was caddying, coaching my daughter, getting her from 79 down to 73, 72, right in there, that's really difficult.
Yeah.
That's like each one of those strokes. Mm-hmm. Every stroke becomes so important. Every penalty stroke is just like killer.
Yeah.
And knowing the rules, what you can do, what you can't do. And the weird thing about golf is there's no golf team. So every other sport, doesn't matter if you're playing soccer or on a swim team, there's always a team you try out for. There's always a coach. There's always a fitness person. There's always there's somebody that puts a schedule together. In golf, there's none of that.
Mm.
So if you got a kid that's 13, 14, he wants to play competitive golf, you take him to a swing coach, $100 an hour, how many hours you want to come this week? One.
Yeah.
One.
One.
And
half
that,
hour?
Yeah.
$5.
Yeah.
$5 fours?
Yeah. My daughter has sold $140,000 in golf lessons last year.
Jesus.
Yeah. But in any case.
She's good, though.
Yeah, well, she's good. She's good at sales, too. She's good. And you will actually learn something.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in any case, so what you do is every one of these golfers that gets good, they have a parent, whether it's Tiger Woods or Jim Furyk. They always talk about their dad coaching them. And you think, why did all these golfers have their parent? And the reason is because there's no team. Mm-hmm. And somebody's got to decide, you're going to play on this tour. I'm going to pay the money for this. We're going to hop in the car. We're going to get a hotel room. I'm going to buy you, you know, we're going to do a practice round one day. You're going to do 2 days of competition. I'm going to drive you home.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's doing that other than the parent. There's no swing coach that's doing that. So you got to decide what tour, when, how do we qualify to get on the top tour in the nation, and then how do you get nationally ranked? Because the top events. So somebody's got to figure this all out. So when you go to these things, it's all these daughters hitting the balls and all these dads stand behind them. And it is.
That's so funny.
Well, it is. Thank God I sold my business, and I was newly divorced, and I'm doing stand-up comedy and coaching golf, and it was a wonderful way to have, hey, you and me against the world. She lived with me full-time. You and me against the world, honey. She was my last kid. She had an interest in something I loved.
Mm.
And, you know, if you're a parent, more than you being successful is watching your kid be successful. Mm. It'll make you cry. It's like, oh, it's such a wonderful experience for me. But it's odd that it's the only professional sports where you talk to any top pro and they'll talk about how their dad coached them.
Yeah.
It's a very weird thing.
Well, I think comedy's similar. And it's like, the more, because I had taken 3 years off golf because I was living in Texas and I didn't have my clubs. I'm a lefty, so no one has lefty clubs.
Yeah, right?
So it's like, I'm like, people are like, you want to play golf? I'm like, you got lefty clubs? No, I guess I'm not playing golf.
Yeah.
But like, when I started playing again, it's so similar to comedy, especially because I'm playing with comics, but it's like every little thing matters. Nobody's forcing you to do it.
Yeah.
It's like comedy. No one's making you do this
shit. Yeah,
yeah. And you know what I mean?
And there's some drama involved when you fuck up.
There's rules, but most people don't know. Most people go out and play golf. They don't know the fucking rule. They walk on your lie. They fucking,
backswing. Yeah.
Comedy, same thing. People are like, hey, man, you know, maybe read the crowd or maybe show up on time or little shit like that. And nobody's doing that. But, you know, when you do start to draw the analogies and stuff, it's like, dude, every shot, every word matters in comedy, just like every stroke matters.
I know.
Matters
change two words, you change the whole rhythm of the joke.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I think I can't say that word now because I got to say that word in the punchline.
Yeah.
So I got to refer to it a different way in the setup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's all these little nuances. It sounds conversational, but it ain't.
And it's also like, so like the main course we play, it's an $18 course, super cheap.
Cool.
It's downtown. It's not downtown. It's by campus, kind of. It's the oldest golf course in Texas, Hancock Golf Course.
Wow.
It's super fun. But there's only the one par five. It's a 9-hole. You play it twice, right?
Is it really steep greens?
No, they're very small.
They're small, old. But they aren't really heavily sloped?
Not crazy. They're pretty flat. There's a couple that are kind of slope, but they're not crazy.
Well, the reason I asked that is because Sammy once played on an old golf course, and the front nine was really old. The second nine was really new. Okay. And in the old days, they didn't mow the greens down as tight, so you could have more slope in the greens because the balls run slower.
There's one that has a...
Yeah, because the balls would run slower. Yeah. And when, as she turned the corner on this course, then they were more manicured, and the greens were a lot faster because the slope wasn't as gradual. So back in the day, they didn't mow them like they do today. Yeah. So in order to get them to bend, they made them steeper. So sometimes that's the case with older courses.
There are a couple steep ones on there. There's the par 5 on there, right? It's a par 70 total, par 35, right?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
But so the one par 5, you know, it dog legs left. So as a lefty, I'm like, oh, this is perfect, right? There's not a lot of dog leg left holes.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, sweet.
So you can hit a fade around that corner a little bit.
No, I can't because it's probably 300 yards from the tee box, especially if you're playing the back tee box.
To the corners, 300?
It's the par 5. So it's like.
Oh,
it's
so
like
you're hitting a fade on your second shot.
Exactly. And it took me a while to figure out how do I get over the creek and up the hill to the green.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm trying, okay, I'm going to hit a 5-wood and then hit a layup and then a 5-iron.
Right. Well, yeah.
So I'm doing.
Strategic.
I thought I was being strategic. So, you know, I've been playing that. We've been playing all summer. And at one point, I just got to, my second or third shot. And I was like, honestly, that's pretty far uphill. It doesn't look that far from when you're like across the river and you want to go to the green. You got to go over a river or up the hill.
Right.
The up the hill thing is what killed me because I'd be like, I know I can get my 5-iron that far.
Yeah.
But not up the hill.
Yeah.
So then one day I was just like, what if I hit my fucking 5-wood? Hit my 5-wood, I'm on the green.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
I'm further away than I thought I was.
Yeah.
I need to, you know. And it's like that in comedy and life and everything. Sometimes you're just like, why isn't this working? It's like, maybe you got to adjust your strategy like completely.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
No, that's exactly good. Actually, one of the more advanced things that I talked to Sammy in golf was golf course strategy. And like when she had a big tournament, we went down to Notre Dame and we went down the day before. And she writes down what club she's going to tee off with on every hole. Mm-hmm. And if we aren't sure, she'll hit a couple different ones. We'll drive out, pick them up, and kind of look at the next shot, and then go back to the tee and hit them again in our practice round. Mm-hmm. And then she'll hit her second shot. We don't have to putt the greens. We'll do a couple to get the speed to the greens. But more than anything, we want to know what clubs and what to aim at, and aim at the tower or play left to right. Or you want to be on the right-hand side because that gives you a better opening in your second shot. But there's different course designers that – there was a guy out of Indiana, I forget his name, Pete Dye. Pete Dye course, if you hit towards trouble on your tee shot, you'll have an easy shot into the green. If you hit away from trouble on your tee shot, you're going to have a more difficult shot into the green. And actually, one of the qualifying questions that her college coach asked her before she gave her the scholarship was, and Sammy had played the course in the high school championships and missed it by one stroke, which sucked. But in any case, that was very frustrating. It was one of those rounds. Yeah, it was, oh, fuck. But in any case, asked her on hole number whatever, which was a kind of short par 5 where there was a creek right in front of the green. So she could be up right next to the creek and then chip over onto the green, but the green was not very deep. So if you hit a pitch and run, you might hit that green and run over the back down into the water. So you didn't want to have something low and fast coming into that. She said, how do you play this hole? And she says, I lay up on my second shot to 100 yards instead of being up by that. She said, why? Because that way I can play a middle wedge hard, hit it really high, and stop it on the green. Mm. If I play up short to that creek, now I'm doing a 7-iron punch and run, and I'm bringing the back jeopardy in where I'm really comfortable. I know she knows exactly her yardage within 3 yards of every club.
Right.
So I know I can hit a full mid wedge in from 100 yards. So I hit to that 100. And if I'm a little bit long, okay, I'll hit a sandwich. If I'm a little bit, you know, short, I'll hit a pitching wedge. But I know I'm hitting a high shot into that hole.
Yeah.
And I'm taking the creek out of play in the front, and I'm taking the water out of play behind it, and I'm making up for that shallow green. But those strategic things are the next level.
And it's, dude, in comedy, your jokes are like your clubs. Right?
Yeah,
you're like, oh, this is, I need to use a wedge here.
Yeah, exactly.
Or it's like, I'm going the driver. Fuck it. They're getting it right now. I'm smacking this one. You know what I mean? And then it's also like, there's the hazards, right? It's like, there's the drunk couple here.
Exactly.
There's the heckler in the back.
Exactly. And who set up this room? It's like setting up the course. Yeah. Like, why did the pro do this to me? But it is what it is.
That's that Josh Adams shit where it's like, I watch him address a room and be like, I don't know why y'all got that there, this there, that.
Yeah,
there.
Exactly.
And so he's like, he's reading the course. It's like reading a green, right?
Yeah.
Where you're like, it's gonna fuck it. It's gonna go that way.
Yeah,
I'm going up a hill. I gotta hit it a little harder.
Yeah,
and so I don't know, man. It's, I mean, you can make an analogy with every sport. I think we've done two sport analogies for comedy.
Yeah, this is what we're best at. Yeah.
But I mean, it's the strategy part and the competition part of it too, where it's just like, you know, you're talking about golf, where you know you're playing against all these top players and stuff like that, or it's, you know, it's all the daughters and then the dads and, you know.
Right.
When you're doing comedy, too, it's just like, if you're not around people who are taking it seriously, if you're not around people who, like, when you play golf with a bad golfer,
Yeah.
When you play golf with a good golfer, you're like, damn, I didn't even think about that. You hit a shot like that, you're like, whoa, okay, I'm not going to try that. Yeah. But now I know that's possible.
Yeah.
I see what you did there.
Well, you know what?
You learn more.
Yeah, I am miserable to golf with if you're a, if you're a social golfer and you want to play your boombox while we play.
Yeah.
I'm not your guy. I'm not your fucking guy. I went on a trip up north at the end of the season. We're playing our championship round, and they brought a guy who wasn't even in our league, so he wasn't in the mix. Mm. And nobody wanted to golf with him. And so they put him with me. Ted, you get along with everybody. You go. And he said, do you mind if I play my music? I said, not if you have ear pods in. Play all the music you want, but I don't want to hear it, dude.
Yeah.
And there are courses where they don't even allow it because not everybody on the other tee wants to hear your fucking rock and roll. Some people are. And in my mind, there's a cerebral part to the golf where you become the watcher. You're in the moment. I mean, there's this whole other realm that I'm trying to get to, and I don't need to hear Bob Seger or fucking, you know, in a Gata DeVito while I'm trying to set up this tee shot and trying to, you know, move the ball from right to left. And he could not understand that because he's a social golfer. So I want to know that up front because I'm probably not your guy because I'm competitive. By nature, I'm out here to really try to golf. It's same as comedy. I am really trying to do comedy. Now, I understand that I'm average.
Yeah.
I get it. But you're going to get my best effort.
Mm-hmm.
I may fail, but it's not from lack of effort, and it's not from lack of me being focused and trying to do what I can do.
Yeah.
And sometimes it kills, and sometimes it fails, such is the nature of golf and comedy.
Yeah.
But that's my nature. I can't imagine you went to Ross Business School and you don't have this drive in you to, like, if I'm fucking doing it, I'm fucking doing it. You know,
when I'm playing golf, you know, my one buddy, Anthony, he was golfing a lot. And then I think he had to slow it down a little bit because he got in a car accident and stuff and some money stuff. But he was golfing probably 3-4 times a week.
He was into it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And when me and him play golf, we play very similarly. He just started a couple of 2-3 years ago. And I started probably when I was 13 or whatever, but then I took a lot of time off, and I started right-handed as a kid and switched to lefty because I play hockey left-handed, I bat left-handed in baseball, so I was like, I should be doing this left-handed.
Yeah.
But when me and him play, you know, we're competitive, but we're also like, because he's trying to be a caddy at the country club, right?
Oh.
That's what he wants to do.
Okay.
So he's, you know, also working on like, hey, I think you should do this, and I'm like, how far you think I am? He's got the gun. And we're like taking it pretty seriously.
Yeah.
We're having fun still. We're playing a public course. Who cares? But, you know, then we got our other buddies when they come out. They're playing music and wearing shorts and this and that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't care. But at the same time, please don't walk on my lie.
Yeah.
Please don't, like, I don't care if you're talking a little bit, but don't fucking get nuts on the backswing.
Yeah.
You know, if you want music, that's fine. But if it's dog shit music, can we turn it the fuck off?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I take it a little seriously because I'm like, hey, man, I got up early. I took time out of my day. I'm spending money on this.
See, you could be miserable, too, if you're with the wrong person.
Oh, yeah. All the time. Yeah, so that's all the time. Yeah. So, like, For me, when I'm playing golf, I'm like, hey, I want to play golf.
Well, I think the objective is to play good enough so you can play with anybody. Yeah. That you're not going to be embarrassment to the foursome, that you're going to be, you don't have to win, but yeah. I want to have a game that's quality enough. Now, I'm old because I'm over 70 now, but I can still drive the ball 240 to 260. So okay. I'm doing okay.
That's about it. But I hit it when I hit it right. Well, I'm thinking about you. Yeah. I don't hit it that far. I play old man golf.
Okay. Well, once in a while, I'll do a 280. Once in a while, I can still do that. But, you know, these girls. I met an 18-year-old girl. I walked it off, hit 315.
Jesus.
Yeah. I know. I mean, with the new equipment, and I my body doesn't twist like that anymore. I don't have that top-end speed I used to have. Now, I haven't played seriously in a number of years. I may take up senior citizen golf at some point in time, you know, when I move into the villages or whatever the fuck I do. and you got 30 courses you golf for free. I mean, that's hard to turn down.
Yeah.
But I may do that, but I do like the social aspect, but I like the competition.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a member of the country club, more than anything, and it was not fancy, but more than anything, I love those early mornings. There's dew still out there on the rough, and everybody's quiet. Everybody's at the range hitting their – everybody's a little bit nervous. I perform better in tournaments. Mm. When people get uptight, it just makes me more focused. And for some reason, my sight – and I've always been this way. You put the pressure on, I'm going to do a little bit better. Mm. You know, and I don't know if I'm more serious, but I also am disconnected from my body. This is a weird thing in comedy, and I don't know anybody else that has this. I get nervous, but I don't know I'm nervous. Mm. I remember standing backstage at Ridley's one time, and I was, I don't know, hosting an open mic or a contest or closing or doing some time so they count. It was one of those things. I don't think I was in an open mic, but it was something where I was going to do more time. And I was standing backstage, and I felt fine, and I thought, oh, my palms are damp. Why are my fucking palms are damp? And I thought, oh, I must be nervous.
Yeah.
Because I've done so much public speaking that it doesn't register in my brain anymore.
Right.
That, like, my body knows I'm nervous, but my working mind has no idea until I notice something. And I think it's the same thing with golf. I may be nervous about it, but I don't know that I am.
Well, it's I think the body reacting to situations and stress, like, yeah, you're going to sweat a little. You're going to have that. But then that's the mental part.
But in golf, you can't be tense.
No. Right. But that's where the mental part
right.
should ease the tension and focus on what you're doing.
Yeah. I won the not the championship flight, but the first flight in our club championship. And I was behind on the second day by 4 strokes going off with the final group in my flight. And I'm like, that's a lot. And I pressed too hard and fell behind another stroke. But then the leader, he shanked one out in the water, and all of a sudden I'm only 2 down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 3 holes to go, one of my buddies in the final group, too, he wasn't the guy that was leading. He said, dude, I think you got this, because I was up by, like, 2 with 3 holes to go. And I said, dude, it's only 2 strokes. 3 holes to go. Anything can fucking happen in golf.
I've lost that lead.
And yeah,
I've lost that lead recently. That's possible.
And I went birdie, birdie, birdie.
There you go. Nice.
And there were the 18th, I had never birdied in my life. And I even had a 4-iron into it. I hate my 4-iron. I thought, dude, that's the club. This is the shot. If you're going to win, you got to hit the shot.
Mm-hmm.
Just hit the fucking shot. That's all I can do. And I hit it up, you know, it was 195 yards to the green, and I put it like 6 feet from the pin. I thought, what the fuck? You know, after just going birdie, birdie on the previous two.
Yeah.
So I just smoked him in the last, maybe my proudest moment in golf, go birdie, birdie, birdie.
I've done 2 birdies in a row. But I have not done 3. But
it was in competition. Was the interesting thing under pressure.
Yeah,
and like apparently I do better under pressure. I don't know.
That's why Bill put you first. He knew otherwise you were going to. He's like, we put him anywhere else. Yeah, it's over.
Put this loser up first. He'll get people going and walk off and pout.
No, but if he puts you in the middle, you're going to win. If he puts you anywhere first, you're going to run away with it.
Yeah, I don't know about that. No, I'm an old white man. I do not win to my age. I'm lucky people will listen to me at my age, you know?
Hey, man, young white man ain't... I don't know if that's any better. But I don't know, man. I just, like... I think comedy is one of those things where, like in golf, if you hit one birdie and then you hit another one, then you're going to hit another one.
Yeah. You're having that day.
Momentum.
I know. I think maybe it is.
And sometimes in comedy, like, man, that first thing that comes out of your mouth, you're like... I don't even know if this is, if it's not a bit, if it's a riff or something about the room.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're like, how do you know this is going to work? That's where I get nervous when I'm like, because I like starting with something that isn't a bit, just some random stuff.
Yeah, right? I do too, but I also put a new joke first, which people say don't do. I actually say something about the room just to say I'm here, I'm familiar. This isn't something I wrote because I'm talking about the previous guy or the room setup. Or,
I'm
here with you. Mm-hmm. And then I do my first joke. That is something that I just wrote in the last week.
Okay.
It's because I know I got lots of time to make up for it.
Yeah.
Now, if that doesn't hit, you don't expect me to necessarily be hot. I just said something decent about the room. You think I'm friendly. I want you to like me, you know, and now I'm going to say this and see how that goes. Sometimes it kills.
Yeah.
And sometimes like, what the fuck? That was kind of cool.
And the worst feeling is when you start with a tried and true joke and it gets nothing.
Oh, that is like, terrible. Yeah, that's terrible.
You might as well have just topped your driver or whatever your best club is off
well,
the
you know,
tee.
Well, you know, you're going to like me. It's just taking time. That's all. Same with all my ex-wives.
Yeah.
It took a while to build up to it. So, you know, there's always a recovery, something you can say.
Yeah.
And if it shows the audience that you're paying attention, you're in the moment, it makes you more likable.
Oh, you know,
I'm with you here. I get it. This ride is not going well, and I'm driving. My bad.
I saw someone fucking, like, acknowledge that it wasn't going good in the set, and it got such a big laugh.
Yeah.
They just go, like, this isn't going good. Yeah. And they just lost it because it wasn't. And they were, I don't know if it was, like, a three-minute set or something short. And it just was rough, and they acknowledged it, and the whole crowd was like, yeah.
We went up to Cadillac, Michigan. Have you ever been to Cadillac, Michigan?
I've heard of it. I don't know exactly where
everybody looks like you. They all look like they're lumberjacks. Like, what the fuck? Big beards and, you know, and baseball cap. I mean, I was like, really? But they really were lumberjacks, some of them. I mean, these were, like, really tough crowd. And I went up there with Sal D'Amelio and Billy Reno. Mm. And, you know, just going anywhere with those guys is fun. The car ride's fun up and back. We had a good time. And it was a nice room, and Sal had set it up. We got paid well. But it was a tough crowd. It really was a tough crowd. And the previous show they did, the guy did all crowd work and walked amongst them. But because it was a small town, everybody knew everybody in the room.
Yeah.
They all went to high school together. It was such a little community that they loved, oh, you're making fun of Pete over there. And then he came over. You know, they loved that shit. And that's what had happened at the previous show. Well, I opened up. And it was rough. It was like, okay, because I'm doing bits and stuff. And I did say something about, I don't know, them looking like they were off the, what was the reference? I think, the show about Duck Dynasty. I did some reference because that's kind of the look of the crowd, and they liked that. Mm. I thought, ooh, if I talk about them, they like that. Well, Billy got up, and he's doing his normal set, and it's just not going good. He looked over behind him, and there was some kind of rope or something hanging off the ceiling. He said, I'm going to hang myself now because that would be more entertaining than any of this. And they liked that because he was in the moment. He's like, I'm with you. I get what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really liked the fact that he brought it back down to reality. Like, I'm going to stop and talk to you now because this routine isn't working. So where can we go? And by the time Sal got up, actually during Billy's set, after I got off, Sal and I were discussing the strategy of the room. He said, they really like the crowd work. And so Sal did more of that than any of us.
Mm-hmm.
But he also struggled a little bit at the end. But Sal was so cool, man. Time was up. The show was over. He did another 10 minutes because he's like, I'm going to fucking get you.
Yeah.
Before I leave.
And he's last. There's no one after him.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to get you. I'm going to do something until I, and he did. And he got him.
Yeah.
But it was just one of those rooms. It was a tough room anyhow. And you're glad for what worked. And they were entertained. I mean, it's Cadillac. They don't see that much comedy.
Right.
So you don't know what they expect. And you don't know how to get them. But it was a good show. It was, you know, like we said, a learning experience for all of us. Reading the crowd, reading the room, trying to figure out from one comic to the next what's working and what isn't working.
And I think, like, in comedy, I don't think audiences like the reciting of like a lines, like a play.
Yeah.
Like they don't want there to be a fourth wall.
Yeah, and right.
It doesn't mean you have to do crowd work or they're allowed to heckle or you have to roast people in the crowd. But the presence of, like, I'm here, This is not the same act you would see if I were in Cincinnati or if I were in South Dakota.
Right.
This is unique for you.
Yeah,
this
I'm
is
here
a
with
unique
you.
Experience.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times people who go to see comedy shows, they want a unique experience. They don't want to see what they see on Netflix. They can stay at home.
Yeah.
They're going to save the money and the gas and everything. But they're just like, I want something unique. I want, and that's why a lot of times, like, certain clips, it was hilarious in the moment, but you put that online and it's like,
not so much.
It's not as funny because you weren't there.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate, but it's like, hey, man, sometimes that's what it is. But hey, your job as a comic, you have a job, and your job is to make them laugh.
Right.
In an original way, and in a way that, like, it's true to your nature. But I think the best way to do it is to, like, also, hey, I know you're here. You're here.
Right.
I'm here.
Right.
And you don't want to get too caught up in, like, hey, you know, anyone else from here? Anyone else? You ask too many questions?
Well, I think that's a cheat. Let's give it up for the room. Let's give it up for the wait staff. Hey, everybody, how many have get as it can it, be a
there's a time and it's place a crutch. For all of it.
Yeah, there can be that. Well, I think if you're the host, you want to get
host,
that shit out of the way.
The host for sure.
Yeah, well, the host out in LA at the starting gate said, "I'm going to do crowd work. I don't want any of you guys to do crowd work." And I thought, cool. And the guy that was closing the show just had a Netflix special or some freaking thing. And I said, no, you're giving me 15 minutes. I don't know you from Adam. And you're giving me 15 minutes on a pro show. You say no crowd work. I'm just telling my jokes.
Yeah.
One of the best sets I ever had. Just falling out of their chairs. Like, you know, it's just like, I don't know why. The time they were laughing at my fucking setups.
Yeah.
And I had to.
That's when it's good.
I know. I had to pause and think. I have no idea why you people are laughing right now, but okay, just keep on laughing. Well, you're riding that wave at that time. Okay, yeah. I'll pause here. I'm good with that.
I hosted for a guy, and I think it's also professional for, if you're hosting for a headliner, you got to ask him, is there anything you don't want me to talk about?
Yeah.
Is there anything, you know?
Yeah, because you don't want to, if you're doing dating apps, I'm not doing dating apps
exactly.
Or whatever.
So I go, is there anything you don't want me to talk about? He's like, honestly, you can talk about whatever. Just don't do crowd work, because I do crowd work.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And I do a lot of crowd work.
Yeah, yeah,
so I'm like, so now I'm like, okay.
That's a different set.
For me now, I have to stick to my material.
Right.
I'm not doing my usual shit. I'm just doing the jokes.
Right.
And it went well. We did six shows. They were, you know, when you're doing six shows and they were all sold out. It was awesome. But like,
wow.
When you're that spoiled, you're like, man, I like this one a little better than this one. This crowd was a little... They would laugh and then pull back. They're still laughing. There's 300 people. What am I bitching about?
Yeah.
But, like, so they were all great shows. But I remember the first show, I was like, I feel like I'm playing basketball left-handed.
Yeah.
Because I'm not. I can
this
only,
is what I normally
I
do. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do, I can do this. I can dribble left-handed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I can't do one of my strengths.
Yeah.
And then the second show went a little better. Then the third show I thought was the best. And then,
yeah.
But the whole weekend was good. But I remember up top when he told me that at the beginning of the weekend, I was like, fuck.
Yeah.
I don't want to accidentally do it either.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And I was, that was the thing where I was like, I was focused. I didn't feel a ton of pressure because I'm like, I'm the host. They're not fucking here to
yeah,
see
yeah,
me.
Yeah, 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 right.
But
right.
I had a great weekend. I had, you know,
right.
I had fun the whole weekend. Everyone did good. I did good. The feature did good. Headliner crushed the whole
yeah,
weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just, it's the communication. And it's just like, hey, man.
Well, you got to know. You got to know what you're doing. Actually, when Billy and I were on tour, I remember sometimes we'd go into a room and go, you know, we'd be talking in the vehicle. We took this RV, and we'd be talking in the vehicle. Oh, man, tonight you ought to do this bit or that bit. Mm. Actually, he talked me into doing one whole set as a deaf person. I did my whole set like this. I haven't heard your jokes either. And they loved it. They were so sympathetic because they thought that I was handicapped.
Yeah.
I broke out of it at the end, and they were okay with it because that was a little scary. But sometimes we'd get in a room, and he'd go, oh, look at this audience. Dude, you got to do your finder chatter in this room. You know, I said, yeah, that's where they're at.
Yeah.
They want something kind of naughty. And I'm like, I say fuck 14 times in this closer. It's 2 minute and 45 second bit. And I say fuck 14 times. Got to be the right crowd. Got to be the right place to do this.
Mm.
And it's all about sex and fucking girls. And, you know, you can't do it for everybody. You know what I mean? But in the right crowd, it really works. Now, one night stands, Green got a hold of me and said, dude, can you give me like 20 to 30 minutes of clean? I said, yeah, if you want it. He said, I need you to open for Rocky Laporte. And Rocky's a good comic out of, I don't know, New York, New Jersey, someplace. But he's a good headliner. But he does clean, and he likes a clean, feature in front of him. And I said, I can do that. And then So I'm all set, and, you know, before a big weekend like that, I'm practicing at home. I'm kind of put my set lifts together, and I'm kind of timing things out and going, I can put leave this in, take this. You know, like music, what do I leave out, what do I leave in? Mm. You know, and I can go to this or that, or I'll either go this track down or this track down. So you got a couple different ways, and I'm going to end with whatever. And so I got it all planned out, and I get to the, you know, and my finder chatter is a long bit. That's a long bit, and I got to set it up with some stuff in front of it. And as soon as I walk in, Mike Green goes, dude, are you going to do your finder chatter? I said, you asked me to do clean. He said, yeah, but I love that bit. I say, dude, I say fuck 14 times in that bit. Yeah. He said, yeah, but that's a really good one, man. You got to do that. And now I'm like, right before the show, I'm going, oh, fuck, okay. Now I'm taking that out. And I was going to do this one-minute closer plus those lead-ins. And I got to, you know, so I'm rewriting this stuff and hoping Rocky Laporte doesn't hate it. Because I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. But Mike Green's running the show, and he's the one who's going to book me again. And if he asks me to do a bit, how do I not do it?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I can tell any of my jokes at any time.
Did you do it?
Yeah, I did it. Yeah. I don't know if Rocky liked it or not, but I did it. I did it, you know, I did it four times. What the fuck are you? Well, four shows, 56 man.
56 fucks?
That's a lot of fucks.
That's a lot of fucks, man.
Well, you know what? In Flint, they love it.
Wow. Well,
yeah. You fucking say fucking every fucking thing. I mean, that's how they talk.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, it is weird that sometimes you get there. And at the last minute, you're going, oh, I got to do something else.
Oh, yeah.
And you go, because that isn't going to work. This is going to work. And if I'm going to entertain them. And I don't think you should always just try to please the audience, but you can read where their sensibilities are, where their sense of humor is.
You're playing the course.
Yeah, exactly. The obstacles that happen to be here tonight.
I'm going to go over this tree. Good fucking luck. You're right next to it.
Yeah. I mean, great strategy.
I mean, I see so many golf memes now on Instagram because of the algorithm, right? They know. You watch one, you watch them all.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are really funny. And there's just a couple where it's like, it just shows a guy and he's standing basically in the forest, right? And there is a slight through line to the tee.
To the green. Yeah, you can see the flag.
You can see the
through
flag.
Through the gap.
And the meme just says, like, you haven't hit a clean shot all day. But you're going to go for it.
I'm due. I can do this.
Yeah.
Like, fuck, no, you can't.
Yeah, no, you can't. And it's just, sometimes you got to, you just
you play the odds. You play the odds.
I'm not a gambler either. That was the all my buddies, they got really into sports gambling. And I'm like, you guys are idiots. I don't know. I mean, I hope you win, but I don't.
Yeah.
I'm not into gambling at all. And so watching them, one of them wanted to take Washington on the spread or whatever. I was
What was the spread?
4.5.
Oh, fuck.
Oh, yeah. I don't think he took it. But the whole time I was like, guys. We were watching the game together to watch the game. Can you not root against my team?
Because I'm playing
on it and you're going to fuck my whole day up.
Yeah.
But it's just, man, I don't know, dude. You gotta play the odds, but you got to be strategic.
Right.
Comedy is so strategic. I hate when I don't write a set list. Because I'll write a set list. I don't think I've ever followed it to a T.
Yeah.
It never goes the
way. Well, because something changes. Yeah.
Something always changes.
Yeah.
I think of something. I timed it out slightly wrong, but like I'm pretty decent with the timing of it. But like not having a game plan to me, and I've done that. I've gone up naked basically, like with nothing, no set list ahead of time, and let's just off the top of the head. And that gets real 50-50.
Right.
And I don't want to do 50-50.
Right.
I want to do the 85-15 where I'm like, at least I know Bill Hicks talked about this too, where he was like, the jokes are what you fall back on when you got nothing to talk about.
Ah,
but you gotta have them.
Yeah,
you
absolutely
can't not have them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I see comics. I'm like, you got nothing to talk about, and you have no jokes to fall back on.
Well, they're not a comic. Now? Yeah.
You're just wasting everyone's time.
Yeah,
man. But I don't know. I comedy is super strategic, and I do think it's competitive, and not in the contest way.
Yeah. Well, I think some people don't understand that nobody is successful alone. And if I help you become successful, you might let me open for you at some show sometime. If I'm on your team, promoting you, why wouldn't you give me a shot?
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to, you can't carry me there, but you certainly can afford opportunities to me. So I think that's important.
Yeah. I mean, so Genevieve got to do her first, like, club headlining set a year ago, actually. It was, like, actually a year ago, January last year. It was at the Velveeta Room, which is a really old room in Austin. It's very small. It's like a 75-seater. But they do, they give local comics some headline spots, right?
Oh, and cool.
The money's really good, too, if you sell it out, right? And
so you're getting a percentage of the door or what?
I think you get 100% of the door.
Oh, cool.
They get all the drinks, you get all the door.
Oh, wow, that's so awesome.
It's a good deal.
Yeah.
So she, you know, three shows, I think one Friday, two Saturday, right? So we're looking at it like, let's get asses in the seats. This is a great opportunity.
Absolutely.
She's letting me feature, thank
God. Oh, cool.
She had her friend Jamisha host and our buddy David Sinifani, who you met.
Yeah.
He was doing a guest spot and he helped us promote.
Is he pretty funny?
He is funny.
Oh, he's a nice guy.
Yeah, so... you know, Velveeta Room can be rough when there's no one there. But we go out on the street, we're barking, we're going. During the day, we go up on Congress, which is kind of where a lot of foot traffic, all the restaurants you're talking
about. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's where people, tourists go.
Yeah.
So we're out there for 2 hours each, this Friday and Saturday, for 2 hours. We got a poster on the light pole, and then we got our little flyers we're handing out with the QR codes. Right?
Sure, cool.
And we're just barking. And I was like, man, I don't know how this is going to go. I have no idea. Who knows? We show up the first night, right? And the bouncer's there, and he barks, too, the whole time. It's cool. He helps.
Yeah.
And he's barking. And we walk up, and he's like, yeah, you guys already have 50 tickets sold for tonight. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, you got 50 tickets sold already. And that's not even, you know, we're going to get foot. We always get foot traffic.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that shocked me. I was like, we got 50 fucking tickets. This shit worked. And then, you know, he barks in, you know, 25. We sell it out.
Yeah.
Next night, you know, Saturday during the day, we go out, we bark, we do the same thing. I'm like, I had two shows. There's no way we sell out two shows. First show up. He's like, hey, y'all got 45 or something already. We sold out the first one, sold out the second one.
No shit.
And I was just like, holy shit. And that was the thing where it's like, because David Sinifani, man, I mean, that guy, he's one of the best promoters, I think, in town.
Yeah,
he's a really good comic, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's what he said. He had shows, he said Sunday. he had you on some of his shows, so I assumed he was putting shows together somehow.
Yeah, he runs a bi-weekly at Sunset called Best Medicine.
Okay, cool.
So, yeah.
He actually asked me if I was going to be, he saw my open mic, and obviously nobody's there to laugh, but he saw that I was actually doing material and asked how long I was going to be around because he does a show. So he was kind of like, I think he was thinking about putting me on his show, which would have been cool. But
I think he would have put you on.
Yeah, but, you know.
Are you gone? When are you leaving?
Saturday morning.
I got you. No worries.
I'm going to Fort Myers, and it's 70 degrees in fucking Fort Myers, and I'm not doing comedy. I'm doing podcast. You know what I figured out? I'm better at podcasting than I am at comedy. You know, I don't know why, if I'm just talky or broaden my background, or I don't know why, but I have more natural talent for podcasting. So if this sucks, people, this is the best thing I do that I do for comedy.
Comedy too. That's a punchline.
There you go.
Now, you know how many comics here don't have the ability to do what you just did, where it's like, flip it. Just
take a look at yourself, idiot.
How do you not know the funny thing to say? That's why, exactly. Like, there's people you talk to them and they know what's funny to say.
Yeah. Well, have you been on podcasts where comics don't even know how to have a conversation?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
I'm like, holy shit. And I don't want to name names, but funny people you know and I know, I've seen them do podcasts, host podcasts, and they're horrible.
Yeah.
And you think.
You'll tell me after, right?
Once the music plays, I'll tell you. But I think this is just a forced conversation, and you aren't listening to what the person said. Mm. You aren't going down the rabbit hole with them.
Yeah.
Why don't you just fucking follow the guy down the rabbit hole?
That's why I like doing podcasts. I like doing other people's podcasts because I come into it like, I mean, I can talk my ass off too. But
I know.
Like, what do you want to talk?
Yeah. I've had comics on. Show was so bad, I haven't put them up. Ooh. And I mean, comics that have been doing comedy for over 20 years.
Yeah.
And such a bad interview. It's like some people get on and they want to do set up punchline. I'm like, dude, that's not our thing. We're just going to talk. And if people find the conversation interesting, they'll tune in.
And there's points to be funny.
Yeah. There's
it's like life. And, there's points.
Well, you know what? If you're engaged enough where you find this conversation interesting, there's going to be other people too, because long form conversations don't happen anymore. You see your buddies, hey, how you doing? You do small talk for what, 30 seconds, 1 minute? Mm. Good friend, maybe 5 minutes. And then you move on to whatever you're doing together.
Yeah.
People don't sit down and have long form conversations unless they're in a car riding someplace together.
Right.
Then you might have an hour conversation. But we've been talking for 2 hours with very little lulls. And people don't do this. Mm. You don't sit down and look face to face and just talk, you know, somebody's on their phone doing, so it, I think people find it engaging to listen to these conversations because they feel like they're involved in it too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I love having, I mean, I see that's.
I'm glad you're going to do a podcast again because I thought you were good at podcasting.
So, yeah, we do. It's called Works Every Time Podcast, comes out every Monday.
Yeah, we should. Yeah, let's tell people so they'll tune in.
It's
that's
a YouTube.
Good thing about being on other podcasts because you can promote to my people in Australia.
Hell yeah. We got all season five. Yeah, listen to Works Every Time. Yeah, fuck it. Yeah, it's Works Every Time Podcast on YouTube. It's on Spotify. I'm not the producer. That was the thing about the old podcast was me and Justin were doing everything. Right?
Yeah.
So now we got a guy who does the camera and the editing and all that stuff.
That's,
he's awesome.
That's hard to do all that shit.
Too. Yeah, and I can do very basic level of that stuff.
Right.
But this guy can like really make it look good. So I appreciate him for doing that. But yeah, that's every Monday it comes out. So.
Cool.
Yeah.
You know what? That's what they say. If you do it regular, you'll be more popular. I am not regular as hell. I haven't put one up probably in 2 months.
Okay.
And, you know, then I'll get on a run and I'll do a bunch of them. And I get a backlog. But I was putting 20 hours into editing.
Oh.
I'd listen to it 3 times. And if I do a 3-hour podcast, okay, I'm into it 9. I'm adjusting your mic compared to my mic. And then I'm doing the intros and the outros. And then I want to put an ad or a funny clip in. And then I put the face pictures together. And what am I going to put on Instagram and TikTok and YouTube? You know, it's just a lot of work to do it. And it's too much.
It's too much. It's a lot.
It is too much.
And that's why, like, I appreciate the guys that I work with on it because they put in a lot of work that I don't know how to do.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of the editing and shit, I'm like, I don't fucking know how to do this stuff.
But yeah.
I would love to help more, and I know I'm going to help more. But yeah, man.
I think that's great. You know what? And I'm looking forward to having your podcast to listen to, actually, as I'm on the road.
Hell yeah.
I'm going to listen to it.
I'm excited.
You know what? I want to thank you for coming in. This is really cool catching up.
Yeah.
Hearing about your comedy, and sounds like you guys are doing great. You're going to have more and more opportunities. So.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. So, hey, good to see you again.
Thank you.
All right, man.
I appreciate it.
Okay, it looks like that's going to be our show for the day. Thanks for tuning in. I want to thank Marcus Olin for coming in and being our special guest and making it such a good one. And I will be continuing my travels. I'm heading down to Florida shortly. And I'll be putting up some more podcasts from there if I can find anybody funny or entertaining to talk to. But until then, be good to each other out there. I know it's winter up north, so don't bump into people. And try and be kind and try to be happy until we talk again. I'm Ted Moss, and those are my thoughts. And with that, Bob's your uncle.